The Lies of Loch Lomora by Scott Lynch. Narrated by Michael Page. Copyright 2006 by Scott Lynch. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Bantam Dell, a division of Random House, Inc., and was produced in the year 2009 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Prologue. The Boy Who Stole Too Much. 1. At the height of the long wet summer of the 77th year of Sendovani, the thief-maker of Camor paid a sudden and unannounced visit to the eyeless priest at the temple of Perelandro, desperately hoping to sell him the Lomora boy.
"Have I got a deal for you?"
the thief-maker began, perhaps inauspiciously.
"Another deal like Carlo and Galdo, maybe," said the eyeless priest. "I've still got my hands full training those giggling idiots out of every bad habit they picked up from you and replacing them with the bad habits I need."
"Now, chains," the thief-maker shrugged. "I told you they were shit-flinging little monkeys when we made the deal, and it was good enough for you at the..."
"Or maybe another deal like Sabatha?"
The priest's richer, deeper voice chased the thief-maker's objection right back down his throat.
"I'm sure you recall charging me everything but my dead mother's kneecaps for her. I should have paid you in copper and watched you spring a rupture trying to haul it all away."
"Ah, but she was special, and this boy, he's special too," said the thief-maker. "Everything you asked me to look for after I sold you Carlo and Galdo. Everything you liked so much about Sabatha. He's Camori, but a mongrel. Therin and Vadran blood with neither dominant. He's got larceny in his heart, sure as the sea's full of fish piss. And I can even let you have him at a discount."
The eyeless priest spent a long moment mulling this.
"You'll pardon me," he finally said, "if the suggestion that the minuscule black turnip you call a heart is suddenly overflowing with generosity toward me leaves me wanting to arm myself and put my back against a wall."
The thief-maker tried to let a vaguely sincere expression scurry onto his face, where it froze in evident discomfort. His shrug was theatrically casual.
"There are problems with the boy, yes. But the problems are unique to his situation in my care. Were he under yours, I'm sure they would vanish."
"Oh, you have a magic boy. Why didn't you say so?"
The priest scratched his forehead beneath the white silk blindfold that covered his eyes.
"Magnificent! I'll plant him in the fucking ground and grow a vine to an enchanted land beyond the clouds."
"Ah, I've tasted that flavor of sarcasm before, chains."
The thief-maker gave an arthritic mock bow.
"That's the sort you spit out as a bargaining posture. Is it really so hard to say that you're interested?"
The eyeless priest shrugged.
"Suppose Carlo, Galdo, and Sabatha might be able to use a new playmate, or at least a new punching bag. Suppose I'm willing to spend about 3 coppers and a bowl of piss for a mystery boy. But you'll still need to convince me that you deserve the bowl of piss. What's the boy's problem?"
"His problem," said the thief-maker, "is that if I can't sell him to you, I'm going to have to slit his throat and throw him in the bay. And I'm going to have to do it tonight."
2. On the night the Lomora boy had come to live under the thief-maker's care, the old graveyard on Shades Hill had been full of children, standing at silent attention and waiting for their new brothers and sisters to be led down into the mausoleums. The thief-maker's wards all carried candles, Their cold blue light shone through the silver curtains of river mist, as street lamps might glimmer through a smoke-grimed window. A chain of ghost light wound its way down from the hilltop, through the stone markers and ceremonial paths, down to the wide glass bridge over the coal-smoke canal, half visible in the blood-warm fog that seeps up from Camor's wet bones on summer nights.
"Come now, my loves, my jewels, my newly-founds, keep the pace!"
whispered the thief-maker as he nudged the last of the 30 or so catch-fire orphans over the coal-smoke bridge.
"These lights are just your new friends, come to guide your way up the hill. Move now, my treasures, there's darkness wasting, and we have so much to talk about."
In rare moments of vain reflection, the thief-maker thought of himself as an artist. A sculptor, to be precise, with orphans as his clay and the old graveyard on Shades Hill as his studio. 88,000 souls generated a certain steady volume of waste. This waste included a constant trickle of lost, useless, and abandoned children. Slavers took some of them, hauling them off to Tal Verar or the Jeremite Islands. Slavery was technically illegal in Camor, of course, but the act of enslavement itself was winked at, if there was no one left to speak for the victim. So slavers got some, and plain stupidity took a few more. Starvation and the diseases it brought were also common ways to go, for those who lacked the courage or the skill to pluck a living from the city around them. And then, of course, those with courage but no skill often wound up swinging from the black bridge in front of the Palace of Patience. The Duke's magistrates disposed of little thieves with the same rope they used on bigger ones, though they did see to it that the little ones went over the side of the bridge with weights tied to their ankles to help them hang properly. Any orphans left after dicing with all of those colourful possibilities were swept up by the thief-maker's own crew, one at a time or in small, frightened groups. Soon enough they would learn what sort of life awaited them beneath the graveyard that was the heart of his realm, where 70 of cast-off children bent the knee to a single bent old man.
"Quick step, my lovelies, my new sons and daughters, follow the line of lights and step to the top. We're almost home, almost fed, almost washed up and bedded down, out of the rain and the mist and the stinking heat."
Plagues were a time of special opportunity for the thief-maker, and the catchfire orphans had crawled away from his very favourite sort, Black Whisper. It fell on the catchfire district from points unknown, and the quarantine had gone up, death by clothyard shaft for anyone trying to cross a canal or escape on a boat, in time to save the rest of the city from everything but unease and paranoia. Black Whisper meant a miserable death for anyone over the age of 11 or 12, as near as physicians could figure, for the plague was not content to reap by overly firm rules, and a few days of harmless swollen eyes and red cheeks for anyone younger. By the 5th day of the quarantine, there were no more screams and no more attempted canal crossings, so Catchfire evaded the namesake fate that had befallen it so many times before in years of pestilence. By the 11th day, when the quarantine was lifted and the Duke's ghouls went in to survey the mess, perhaps 1 in 8 of the 400 children previously living there had survived the wait. They had already formed gangs for mutual protection and had learned certain cruel necessities of life without adults. The thief-maker was waiting as they were corralled and led out from the sinister silence of their old neighbourhood. He paid good silver for the best 30, and even more good silver for the silence of the ghouls and constables he relieved of the children. Then he led them, dazed and hollow-cheeked and smelling like hell, into the dark steam-bath mists of the Camori night, toward the old graveyard on Shades Hill. The Lamora boy was the youngest and smallest of the lot, 5 or 6 years old, nothing but jutting bones under skin rich with dirt and hollow angles. The thief-maker hadn't even chosen him. The boy had simply crept away with the others, as though he belonged. The thief-maker was not unaware of this, but he'd lived the sort of life in which even a single free plague orphan was a windfall not to be overlooked. It was the summer of the 77th year of Gandalo, father of opportunities, lord of coin and commerce. The thief-maker padded through the shrouded night, shepherding his ragged line of children. In just 2 years he would be all but begging Father Chains, the eyeless priest, to take the Lamora boy off his hands, and sharpening his knives in case the priest refused. 3. The eyeless priest scratched his grey stubbled throat. No shit.
None whatsoever.
The thief-maker reached down the front of a doublet that was several years past merely shabby, and pulled out a leather pouch on a fine leather cord. The pouch was dyed the rust red of dried blood.
Already went to the big man and got permission. I'll do the boy ear to ear and send him for teeth lessons.
Gods, it's a sob story after all.
For an eyeless priest, the fingers he jabbed into the thief-maker's sternum struck swift and sure.
Find some other lackwit to shackle with the chains of your conscience.
Conscience can go piss up a chimney, Chains. I'm talking avarice, yours and mine. I can't keep the boy, and I'm offering you a unique opportunity, a genuine bargain.
If the boy's too unruly to keep, why can't you just pound some wisdom into him and let him ripen to a proper age of sale?
Out of the question, Chains. Limited options. I can't just slap him around because I can't let any of the other little shits know what he's done. If any of them had the slightest inclination to pull what he's pulled, gods, I'd never be able to control them again. I can either kill him quick or sell him quicker. No profit versus a paltry sum. So guess which one I prefer.
The boy's done something you can't even mention in front of the others.
Chains massaged his forehead above the blindfold and sighed.
Shit! This sounds like something I might actually be interested in hearing.
4. An old Komori proverb has it that the only constant in the soul of man is inconstancy. Anything and everything else can pass out of fashion, even something as utilitarian as a hill stuffed full of corpses. Shades Hill was the first graveyard of quality in Komor's history, ideally situated to keep the bones of the formerly well-fed above the salty grasp of the Iron Sea. Yet over time, the balance of power shifted in the families of vault-carvers and morticians and professional pallbearers. Fewer and fewer of the quality were interned on Shades Hill, as the nearby Hill of Whispers offered more room for larger and gaudier monuments with commensurately higher commissions. Wars, plagues, and intrigues ensured that the number of living families with monuments to tend on Shades Hill dropped steadily over the decades. Eventually, the only regular visitors were the priests and priestesses of Azaguia, who sleep in tombs during their apprenticeships, and the homeless orphans who squatted in the dust and darkness of the ill-tended burial vaults. The thief-maker, though of course he wasn't known as such just yet, had wound up sharing one of these vaults at the low point of his life, when he was nothing but a miserable curiosity, a pickpocket with 9 broken fingers. At first, his relationship with the Shades Hill orphans was half bullying and half pleading. Some vestigial need for an authority figure kept them from killing him in his sleep. For his part, he grudgingly began to explain to them some of the tricks of his trade. As his fingers slowly mended, after a fashion, for most of them would forever resemble twice-broken twigs, he began to impart more and more of his crooked wisdom onto the dirty children who dodged the rain and the city watch with him. Their numbers increased, as did their income, and they began to make more room for themselves in the wet stone chambers of the old graveyard. In time, the brittle-boned pickpocket became the thief-maker, and Shades Hill became his kingdom. The Lamora boy and his fellow catchfire orphans entered this kingdom some 20 years after its founding. What they saw that night was a graveyard no deeper than the dirt piled above the old tombs. A great network of tunnels and galleries had been dug between the major vaults, their hard-packed walls threaded with supports like the ribs of long-dead wooden dragons. The previous occupants had all been quietly disinterred and dropped into the bay. Shades Hill was now an ant-mound of orphan thieves. Down the black mouth of the topmost mausoleum, the Catchfire orphans went, down the wood-ribbed tunnel lit by the flickering silver fire of cool alchemical globes, with greasy tendrils of mist chasing at their ankles. Shades Hill orphans watched them from every nook and warren, their eyes cold but curious. The thick tunnel air was saturated with the smells of night soil and stale bodies, an odour the Catchfire orphans soon multiplied with their own presence.
"In! In!"
cried the thief-maker, rubbing his hands together.
"My home, your home, and welcome to it. Here we all have one thing in common. No mothers and no fathers. Alas for that! But now you'll have as many sisters and brothers as you can need, and dry earth over your head. A place! A family!"
A train of Shades Hill orphans swept down the tunnel in his wake, snuffing their eerie blue candles as they went, until only the silver radiance of the wall globes remained to light the way. At the heart of the thief-maker's realm was a vast warm hollow with a packed dirt floor, perhaps twice the height of a tall man, 30 yards wide and long. A single high-backed chair of oiled black witchwood stood against the far wall. The thief-maker eased himself into this with a grateful sigh. Dozens of grotty blankets were set out on the floor, covered with food, bowls of bony chicken marinated in cheap almond wine, soft thresher fish tails wrapped in bacon and soaked in vinegar, and brown bread flavoured with sausage grease. There were also salted peas and lentils, as well as bowls of past ripe tomatoes and pears. Poor stuff, in truth, but in a quantity and variety most of the Catchfire orphans had never seen before. Their attack on the meal was immediate and uncoordinated. The thief-maker smiled indulgently.
"I'm not stupid enough to get between you and a decent meal, my dears. So eat your fill. Eat more than your fill. Make up for lost time. We'll talk after."
As the Catchfire orphans stuffed their faces, the Shades Hill orphans crowded in around them, watching and saying nothing. Soon the chamber was packed, and the air grew staler still. The feasting continued until there was literally nothing left. The survivors of the Black Whisper sucked the last vinegar and grease from their fingers, and then turned their eyes warily to the thief-maker and his minions. The thief-maker held up 3 crooked fingers, as though on cue.
"Business!" he cried. "3 items of business. You're here because I paid for you. I paid extra to get to you before anyone else could. I can assure you that every single one of your little friends that I didn't pay for has gone to the slavers. There's nothing else to be done with orphans. No place to keep you, nobody to take you in. The watch sells your salt for wine money, my dears. Watch sergeants neglect to mention you in their reports, and watch captains neglect to give a shit. And," he continued, "now that the Catchfire quarantine's lifted, every slaver and would-be slaver in Camor is going to be very excited and very alert. You're free to get up and leave this hill any time you see fit, with my confident assurance that you'll soon be sucking cocks or chained to an oar for the rest of your life. Which leads me to my second point. All of my friends you see around you," he gestured to the Shades Hill orphans lined up against the walls, "can leave whenever they please, and mostly go wherever they please, because they are under my protection. I know," he said with a long and solemn face, "that I am nothing especially formidable when considered as an individual, but do not be misled. I have powerful friends, my dears. What I offer is security by virtue of those friends. Should anyone, a slaver, for example, dare to set a hand on one of my Shades Hill boys or girls, well, the consequences would be immediate and gratifyingly merciless.
When none of his newcomers seemed appropriately enthusiastic, the thief-maker cleared his throat.
I'd have the miserable fucking bastards killed! Savvy?
They were indeed.
Which brings us neatly to my third item of interest, namely, all of you. This little family always needs new brothers and sisters, and you may consider yourselves invited, encouraged, no less, to condescend to offer us the pleasure of your intimate and permanent acquaintance. Make this hill your home, myself your master, and these fine boys and girls your trusted siblings. You'll be fed, sheltered, and protected. Or you can leave right now and end up as fresh fruit in some whorehouse in Jerem. Any takers?
None of the newcomers said anything.
I knew I could count on you, my dear, dear catchfire jewels.
The thief-maker spread his arms wide and smiled, revealing a half-moon of teeth brown as swamp water.
But of course, there must be responsibilities. There must be give and take, like for like. Food doesn't sprout from my arsehole. Chamber pots don't empty themselves. Catch my meaning?
There were hesitant nods from about half the catchfire orphans.
The rules are simple. You'll learn them all in good time. For now, let's keep it like this. Anybody who eats, works. Anyone who works, eats. Which brings us to my fourth... Oh, dear. Children, children. Do an absent-minded old man the favour of imagining that he held up four fingers. This is my fourth important point. Now, we've got our chores here on the hill, but we've got chores elsewhere that also need doing. Other jobs, delicate jobs, unusual jobs, fun and interesting jobs, all about the city, some by day and some by night. They will require courage, deftness and discretion. We would so love to have your assistance with these special tasks.
He pointed to the one boy he hadn't paid for, the small hanger-on, now staring up at him with hard, sullen eyes above a mouth still plastered with tomato innards.
You, surplus boy, 31st of 30, what say you? Are you the helpful sort? Are you willing to assist your new brothers and sisters with their interesting work?
The boy mulled this over for a few seconds.
You mean,
he said in a high, thin voice,
that you want us to steal things?
The old man stared down at the little boy for a very long time, while a number of the Shades Hill orphans giggled behind their hands.
Yes,
the thief-maker said at last, nodding slowly.
I might just mean that. Though you have a very uncompromising view of a certain exercise of personal initiative that we prefer to frame in more artfully indeterminate terms. Not that I expect that to mean anything to you. What's your name, boy?
Lamora.
Your parents must have been misers to give you nothing but a surname. What else did they call you?
The boy seemed to think very deeply about this.
I'm called Locke,
he finally said,
after my father.
Very good. Rolls right off the tongue, it does. Well, Locke after your father, Lamora, you come here and have a word with me. The rest of you shuffle off. Your brothers and sisters will show you where you'll be sleeping tonight. They'll also show you where to empty this and where to put that. Chores, if you savvy. Just to tidy this hall up for now, but there'll be more jobs for you in the days to come. I promise it will all make sense by the time you find out what they call me in the world beyond our little hill.
Locke moved to stand beside the thief-maker on his high-backed throne. The throng of newcomers rose and milled about until larger, older Shades Hill orphans began collaring them and issuing simple instructions. Soon enough, Locke and the master of Shades Hill were as alone as they could hope to be.
"My boy," the thief-maker said, "I'm used to having to train a certain reticence out of my new sons and daughters when they first arrive in Shades Hill. Do you know what reticence is?"
The Lamora boy shook his head. His greasy, dust-brown bangs were plastered down atop his round little face, and the tomato stains around his mouth had grown drier and more unseemly. The thief-maker dabbed delicately these stains with one cuff of his tattered blue coat. The boy didn't flinch.
"It means they've been told that stealing things is bad, and I need to work around that until they get used to the idea. Savvy? Well, you don't seem to suffer from any such reticence, so you and I might just get along. Stolen before, have you?"
The boy nodded.
"Before the plague, even?"
Another nod.
"Thought so. My dear, dear boy, you didn't, lose your parents to the plague now, did you?"
The boy looked down at his feet and barely shook his head.
"So you've already been, looking after yourself for some time. It's nothing to be ashamed of now. It might even secure you a place of some respect here, if only I can find the means to put you to the test."
By way of response, the Lamora boy reached under his rags and held something out to the thief-maker. Two small leather purses fell into the old man's open palm. Cheap things, stiff and stained, with frayed cords around their necks.
"Where did you get these, then?"
"The watchman,"
Locke whispered.
"Some of the watchmen picked us up and carried us."
The thief-maker jerked back as though an asp had just sunk its fangs into his spine and stared down at the purses with disbelief.
"You lifted these from the fucking city watch? From the Yellow Jackets?"
Locke nodded more enthusiastically.
"They picked us up and carried us."
"Gods,"
the thief-maker whispered.
"Oh, gods! You may have just fucked us all superbly, look after your father, Lamora. Quite superbly, indeed."
5.
"He broke the secret peace the first night I had him, the cheeky little bastard."
The thief-maker was now seated more comfortably in the rooftop garden of the eyeless priest's temple, with a tarred leather cup of wine in his hands. It was the sourest sort of second-hand near-vinegar, but it was another sign that genuine negotiations might yet break out.
"Never happened before nor since."
"Someone taught him to charm a coot, but didn't tell him that the Yellow Jackets were strictly off-limits."
Father Chains pursed his lips.
"Very curious, that. Very curious indeed. Our dear Kappa Barsavi would so love to meet such an individual."
"I never found out who it was. The boy claimed he'd just taught himself, but that's crap. 5-year-olds play with dead fish and horse turds, Chains. They don't invent the finer points of soft-touching and purse-cutting on a whim."
"What did you do about the purses?"
"I flew back to Catchfire Watch Station and kissed arses and boots until my lips were black. Explained to the watch captain in question that one of the newcomers didn't understand how things worked in Camor, and that I was returning the purses with interest, begging their magnanimous apologies and all the gracious etc. etc.'s."
"And they accepted?"
"Money makes a man mirthful, Chains. I stuffed those purses full to bursting with silver. Then I gave every man in the squad drink money for 5 or 6 nights, and we all agreed they would hoist a few to the health of Kappa Barsavi, who surely needn't be troubled by something as inconsequential as his loyal thief-maker fucking up and letting a 5-year-old breach the bloody peace.
So, the eyeless priest said, that was just the very first night of your association with my very own mystery windfall bargain boy.
I'm gratified that you're starting to take a possessive bent to the little cast chains, because it only gets more colourful. I don't know quite how to put it. I've got kids that enjoy stealing. I've got kids that don't think about stealing one way or another, and I've got kids that just tolerate stealing because they know they've got nothing else to do. But nobody, and I mean nobody, has ever been hungry for it like this boy. If he had a bloody gash across his throat and a physica was trying to sew it up, Lamora would steal the needle and thread and die laughing. He steals too much.
"Steals too much," the eyeless priest mused. "Of all the complaints, I never thought I'd hear from a man who trains little thieves for a living."
"Laugh now," the thief-maker said. "Here's the kicker."
6 Months passed. Parthis became Festal, became Aurim, and the misty squalls of summer gave way to the harder driving rains of winter. The 77th year of Gandalo became the 77th year of Morgante, the city father, lord of noose and trowel. 8 of the 31 catchfire orphans, somewhat less than adept at the thief-maker's delicate and interesting tasks, swung from the black bridge before the Palace of Patience. So it went. The survivors were too preoccupied with their own delicate and interesting tasks to care. The Society of Shades Hill, as Locke soon discovered, was firmly divided into 2 tribes, Streets and Windows. The latter was a smaller, more exclusive group that did all of its earning after sunset. They crept across roofs and down chimneys, picked locks and slid through barred embrasures, and would steal everything from coins and jewellery to blocks of lard in untended pantries. The boys and girls of Streets, on the other hand, prowled Camor's alleys and cobbles and canal bridges by day, working in teams. Older and more experienced children, clutchers, worked at the actual pockets and purses and merchant stalls, while the younger and less capable, teasers, arranged distractions, crying for non-existent mothers or feigning illness or rushing madly around crying, "Stop thief!" in every direction while the clutchers made off with their prizes. Each orphan was shaken down by an older or larger child after returning to the graveyard from any visit outside. Anything stolen or gathered was passed through the hierarchy of bruisers and bullies until it reached the thief-maker, who ticked off names on an eerily accurate mental list as the day's catch came in. Those who produced got to eat. Those who didn't got to practice twice as hard that evening. Night after night, the thief-maker would parade around the warrens of Shades Hill, laden down with money pouches, silk handkerchiefs, necklaces, metal coat buttons, and a dozen other sorts of valuable oddments. His wards would strike at him from concealment or by feigned accident. Those he spotted or felt in the act were immediately punished. The thief-maker preferred not to beat the losers of these training games, though he could work a mean switch when the mood was upon him. Rather, they were forced to drink from a flask of unalloyed ginger oil while their peers gathered around and chanted derisively. Camori ginger oil is rough stuff, not entirely incomparable, as the thief-maker himself opined, to swallowing the smouldering ashes of poison oak. Those who wouldn't open their mouths had it poured into their noses, while older children held them upside down. This never had to happen twice to anyone. In time, even those with ginger-scalded tongues and swollen throats learned the rudiments of coat-teasing and borrowing from the wares of unwary merchants.
The thief-maker enthusiastically instructed them in the architecture of doublets, waistcoats, frock-coats, and belt-pouches, keeping up with all the latest fashions as they came off the docks. His wards learned what could be cut away, what could be torn away, and what must be teased out with deft fingers.
"The point, my loves, is not to hump the subject's leg like a dog, or clutch their hand like a lost babe. Half a second of actual contact with the subject is often too long by far."
The thief-maker mimed a noose going around his neck and let his tongue bulge out past his teeth.
"You will live or die by three sacred rules. First, always ensure that the subject is nicely distracted, either by your teasers or by some convenient bit of unrelated bumfuckery, like a fight or a house fire. House fires are marvellous for our purposes. Cherish them. Second, minimise, and I damn well mean minimise, contact with the subject even when they are distracted."
He released himself from his invisible noose and grinned slyly.
"Lastly, once you've done your business, clear the vicinity even if the subject is as dumb as a box of hammers. What did I teach you? Clutch once, then run," his students chanted. "Clutch twice, get hung."
New orphans came in by ones and twos. Older children seemed to leave the hill every few weeks with little ceremony. Locke presumed that this was evidence of some category of discipline well beyond ginger oil, but he never asked, as he was too low in the hill's pecking order to risk it or trust the answers he would get. As for his own training, Locke went to streets the day after he arrived, and was immediately thrown in with the teasers, punitively, he suspected. By the end of his second month, his skills had secured him elevation to the ranks of the clutchers. This was considered a step up in social status, but Lamora alone in the entire hill seemed to prefer working with the teasers long after he was entitled to stop. He was sullen and friendless inside the hill, but teasing brought him to life. He perfected the use of overchewed orange pulp as a substitute for vomit. Where other teasers would simply clutch their stomachs and moan, Locke would season his performances by spewing a mouthful of warm white and orange slop at the feet of his intended audience, or, if he was in a particularly perverse mood, all over their dress hems or leggings. Another favourite device of his was a long dry twig concealed in one leg of his breeches and tied to his ankle. By rapidly going down to his knees, he could snap this twig with an audible noise. This, followed by a piercing wail, was an effective magnet for attention and sympathy, especially in the immediate vicinity of a wagon wheel. When he'd teased the crowd long enough, he would be rescued from further attention by the arrival of several other teasers, who would loudly announce that they were dragging him home to mother, so he could see a physicker. His ability to walk would be miraculously recovered just as soon as he was hauled around a corner. In fact, he worked up a repertoire of artful teases so rapidly that the thief-maker had cause to take him aside for a second private conversation. This after Locke arranged the inconvenient public collapse of a young lady's skirt and bodice with a few swift strokes of a finger-knife.
"Look here, look after your father, Lamora," the thief-maker said. "No ginger oil this time, I assure you, but I would greatly prefer your teases to veer sharply from the entertaining and back to the practical."
Locke merely stared up at him and shuffled his feet.
"I shall speak plainly, then. The other teasers are going out day after day to watch you, not to do their bloody jobs. I'm not feeding my own private theatre troupe. Get my crew of happy little jack-offs back to their own teasing, and quit being such a celebrity with your own."
For a time after that, everything was serene. Then, barely 6 months after he arrived at the hill, Locke accidentally burned down the Elderglass Vine Tavern, and precipitated a quarantine riot that very nearly wiped the Narrows from the map of Camor. The Narrows was a valley of warrens and hovels at the northernmost tip of the bad part of the city. Kidney-shaped and something like a vast amphitheatre, the island's heart was 40-odd feet beneath its outer edges. Leaning rows of tenement houses and windowless shops jutted from the tiers of this great seething bowl. Wall collapsed against wall, and alley folded upon mist-silvered alley, so that no level of the narrows could be traversed by more than two men walking abreast. The elderglass vine crouched over the cobblestones of the road that passed west and crossed via stone bridge from the narrows into the green depths of the Mare Camorazza. It was a sagging three-story beast of weather-warped wood, with rickety stairs inside and out that maimed at least one patron a week. Indeed, there was a lively pool going as to which of the regulars would be the next to crack his skull. It was a haunt of pipe-smokers and of gaze addicts, who would squeeze the precious drops of their drug onto their eyeballs in public and lie there shuddering with visions while strangers went through their belongings or used them as tables. The 77th year of Morgante had just arrived when Loch Lamora burst into the common room of the elderglass vine, sobbing and sniffling, his face showing the red cheeks, bleeding lips and bruised eyes that were characteristic of Black Whisper.
"Please, sir,"
he whispered to a horrified bouncer while dice-throwers, bartenders, whores and thieves stopped to stare.
"Please, mother and father are sick. I don't know what's wrong with them. I'm the only one who can move. You must..."
Sniff.
"Help, please, sir."
At least that's what would have been heard had the bouncer not triggered a headlong exodus from the elderglass vine by screaming, "Whisper! Black Whisper!" at the top of his lungs. No boy of Locke's size could have survived the ensuing orgy of shoving and panic had not the badge of illness on his face been better than any shield. Dice clattered to tabletops and cards fluttered down like falling leaves. Tin mugs and tarred leather ale jacks spattered cheap liquor as they hit the floor. Tables were overturned, knives and clubs were pulled to prod others into flight, and gazers were trampled as an undisciplined wave of human detritus surged out every door save that in which Locke stood, pleading uselessly, or so it seemed, to screams and turned backs. When the tavern had cleared of everyone but a few moaning or motionless gazers, Locke's companions stole in behind him. A dozen of the fastest teasers and clutchers in streets, specially invited by Lamora for this expedition. They spread out among the fallen tables and behind the battered bar, plucking wildly at anything valuable. Here a handful of discarded coins, there a good knife. Here a set of whalebone dice with tiny garnet chips for markers. From the pantry, baskets of coarse but serviceable bread, salted butter in grease paper, and a dozen bottles of wine. Half a minute was all Locke allowed them, counting in his head while he rubbed his make-up from his face. By the end of the count, he motioned his associates back out into the night. Riot drums were already beating to summon the watch, and above their rhythm could be heard the first faint flutings of pipes, the bone-chilling sound that called out the Duke's ghouls, the quarantine guard. The participants in Locke's smash-and-grab adventure threaded their way through the growing crowds of confused and panicked Narrows dwellers and scuttled home indirectly through the Mare Camorazza or the Coal Smoke District. They returned with the largest haul of goods and food in the memory of the Shades Hill orphans, and a larger pile of copper half-barons than Locke had hoped for. He hadn't known that men who played at dice or cards kept money out in plain view, for in Shades Hill such games were the exclusive domain of the oldest and most popular orphans, and he was neither. For a few hours the thief-maker was merely bemused. But that night, panicked drunks set fire to the elderglass vine, and hundreds tried to flee the narrows when the city watch was unable to locate the boy who'd first triggered the panic. Riot drums beat until dawn, bridges were blocked, and Duke Nicovante's archers took to the canals around the narrows in flat-bottomed boats with arrows to last all night and then some. The next morning found the thief-maker once again in private conversation with his little plague orphan.
"The problem with you, Locke fucking Lamora," is that you are not circumspect. Do you know what circumspect means?
Locke shook his head.
Let me put it like this. That tavern had an owner. That owner worked for Kappa Barsavi, the big man himself, just like I do. Now, that tavern owner paid the Kappa, just like I do, to avoid accidents. Thanks to you, he's had one hell of an accident, even though he was paying his money and didn't have an accident forthcoming. So if you follow me, inciting a pack of drunk fucking animals to burn that place to the ground with a fake plague scare was the opposite of a circumspect means of operation. So now can you venture a guess as to what the word means?
Locke knew a good time to nod vigorously when he heard it.
Unlike the last time you tried to send me to an early grave, this one I can't buy my way out of, and thank the gods I don't need to, because the mess is huge. The Yellow Jackets clubbed down 200 people last night before they all figured out that nobody had the whisper. The Duke called out his fucking regulars and was about to give the Narrows a good scrubbing with fire oil. Now, the only reason, and I mean the only reason, that you're not floating in a shark's stomach with a very surprised expression on your face is that the elderglass vine is just a pile of ashes. Nobody knows anything was stolen from it before it became that pile of ashes. Nobody except us. So, we're all going to agree that nobody in this hill knows anything about what happened, and you are going to relearn some of that reticence I talked about when you first arrived here. You remember reticence, right?
Locke nodded.
I just want nice, neat little jobs from you, Lamora. I want a purse here, a sausage there. I want you to swallow your ambition, shit it out like a bad meal, and be a circumspect little teaser for about the next 1,000 years. Can you do that for me? Don't rob any more Yellow Jackets. Don't burn any more taverns. Don't start any more fucking riots. Just pretend to be a coarse-witted little cutpurse like your brothers and sisters. Clear?
Again Locke nodded, doing his best to look rueful.
Good. And now,
the thief-maker said as he produced his nearly full flask of ginger oil,
we're going to engage in some reinforcement of my admonishments.
And for a time, once Locke recovered his powers of speech and unlaboured breathing, everything was serene. But the 77th year of Morgante became the 77th year of Sendovani, and though Locke succeeded in hiding his actions from the thief-maker for a time, on one more specific occasion he again failed spectacularly to be circumspect. When the thief-maker realized what the boy had done, he went to see the Kappa of Camor and secured permission for one little death. Only as an afterthought did he go to see the eyeless priest, intent not on mercy, but on one last chance for a slim profit. 7. The sky was a fading red, and nothing remained of the day save for a line of molten gold slowly lowering on the western horizon. Locke Lamora trailed in the long shadow of the thief-maker, who was leading him to the temple of Perelandro to be sold. At long last, Locke had discovered where the older children had been disappearing to. A great glass arch led from the northwest base of Shades Hill to the eastern edge of the long, vast temple district. At the apex of this bridge, the thief-maker paused and stared north across the lightless houses of the quiet, across the mist-wreathed waters of the rushing Angevine, to the shaded manors and tree-lined white stone boulevards of the four Alcigrante Islands, laid out in opulence beneath the impossible height of the five towers. The five were the most prominent elderglass structures in a city thick with the arcane substance. The smallest and least magnificent, Dawncatcher, was merely 80 feet wide and 400 feet tall. The true colour of each smooth tower was mingled now with the sinking furnace light of sunset, and the web-like net of cables and cargo baskets that threaded the tower tops was barely visible against the carmine sky.
"We'll wait here a moment, boy,"
said the thief-maker with uncharacteristic wistfulness in his voice.
"Here on my bridge. So few come to Shades Hill this way, it might as well be mine."
The Duke's wind that blew in from the Iron Sea by day had turned. The night, as always, would be ruled by the muggy hangman's wind that blew from land to sea, thick with the scents of farm fields and rotting marshes.
"I'm getting rid of you, you know,"
the thief-maker added after a moment.
"Not, fooling. Goodbye forever. It's a pity you're missing something. Common sense, perhaps."
Locke said nothing, instead staring up at the vast glass towers as the sky behind them drained of colour. The blue-white stars brightened, and the last rays of the sun vanished in the west like a great eye closing. As the first hint of true darkness seemed to fall over the city, a new light rose faint and glimmering to push it back. This light gleamed from within the elder glass of the five towers themselves, and within the translucent glass of the bridge on which they were standing. It waxed with every passing breath, gaining strength until it bathed the city with the fey half-light of an overcast day. The hour of false light had come. From the heights of the five towers to the obsidian smoothness of the vast glass breakwaters, to the artificial reefs beneath the slate-coloured waves, false light radiated from every surface and every shard of elder glass in Camor, from every speck of the alien material left so long before by the creatures that had first shaped the city. Every night, as the west finally swallowed the sun, the glass bridges would become threads of firefly light. The glass towers and glass avenues and the strange glass sculpture gardens would shimmer wanly with violet and azure and orange and pearl white, and the moons and stars would fade to grey. This was what passed for twilight in Camor, the end of work for the last daylight labourers, the calling of the night watches and the sealing of the landward gates, an hour of supernatural radiance that would soon enough give way to true night.
"Let's be about our business,"
the thief-maker said, and the two of them headed down into the temple district, walking on soft alien light. 8. False light was the last hour during which the temples of Camor traditionally remained open, and the eyeless priest at the house of Perelandro was wasting none of the time still left to fill the copper money kettle sitting before him on the steps of his decrepit temple.
"Oh!"
he bellowed in a voice that would have been at home on a battlefield.
"Are we not all orphaned sooner or later? Alas for those torn from the mother's bosom, barely past infancy."
A pair of slender young boys, presumably orphans, were seated on either side of the money kettle, wearing hooded white robes. The eldritch glow of false light seemed to inflame the hollow blackness of their staring eyes as they watched men and women hurrying about their business on the squares and avenues of the gods.
"Alas," the priest continued, "for those cast out by cruel fate to a wicked world that has no place for them, a world that has no use for them. Slaves is what it makes of them, slaves or worse. Playthings for the lusts of the wicked and the ungodly, forcing them into half-lives of unspeakable degeneracy, beside which mere slavery would be a blessing."
Locke marvelled, for he had never seen a stage performance or heard a trained orator. Here was scorn that could boil standing water from stone. Here was remonstrance that made his pulse race with excited shame, though he was himself an orphan. He wanted to hear the big-voiced man yell at him some more. So great was the fame of Father Chains, the eyeless priest, that even Locke Lamora had heard of him, a man of late middle years with a chest as broad as a scrivener's desk and a beard that clung to his craggy face like a pad of scrubbing wool. A thick white blindfold covered his forehead and his eyes. A white cotton vestment hung to his bare ankles, and a pair of black iron manacles encircled his wrists. Heavy steel chains led from these manacles back up the steps of the temple and through the open doors to the interior. Locke could see that as Father Chains gestured to his listeners, these chains were almost taut. He was nearly at the very limit of his freedom. For 13 years, popular lore had it, Father Chains had never set foot beyond the steps of his temple. As a measure of his devotion to Perelandro, Father of Mercies, Lord of the Overlooked, he had chained himself to the walls of his inner sanctuary with iron manacles that had neither locks nor keys, and had paid a physicker to pluck out his eyes while a crowd watched. "The Lord of the Overlooked keeps vigil on every son and daughter of the dead. On that point I can assure you. Blessed in his eyes are those unbound by the duties of blood who render aid and comfort to the motherless and the fatherless." Though he was known to be blind as well as blindfolded, Locke could have sworn that Father Chain's head turned toward himself and the thief-maker as they approached across the square. "Out of the undoubted goodness of their hearts, they nourish and protect the children of Camor. Not with cold-souled avarice, but with selfless kindness. Truly blessed," he hissed with fervor, "are the protectors of Camor's gentle, needful orphans." As the thief-maker reached the steps of the temple and started up, he was careful to slap his heels against the stones to announce his presence. "Someone approaches," Father Chain said. "Two someones, or so say my ears."
"I've brought you the boy we discussed, Father," the thief-maker announced, loudly enough for several passers-by to hear him, should they be listening. "I've prepared him as well as I could for the tests of apprenticeship and initiation."
The priest took a step toward Locke, dragging his clattering chains behind him. The hooded boys guarding the money kettle spared Locke a brief glance, but said nothing.
"Have you, then?"
Father Chain's hand shot out with alarming accuracy, and his calloused fingers spidered themselves over Locke's forehead, cheeks, nose, and chin.
"A small boy, it seems, a very small boy, though not without a certain measure of character, I venture, in the malnourished curves of his sad orphan's face."
"His name," said the thief-maker, "is Locke Lamora, and I wager the Order of Perelandro will find many uses for his, unusual degree of personal initiative."
"Better still," the priest rumbled, "that he was sincere, penitent, honest, and inclined to discipline. But I have no doubt that his time in your affectionate care has instilled those qualities in him by example."
He clapped his hands together 3 times.
"My boys, our day's business is done. Gather the offerings of the good people of Camor, and let's show our prospective initiate into the temple."
The thief-maker gave Locke a brief squeeze on the shoulder, then pushed him quite enthusiastically up the steps toward the eyeless priest. As the white-robed boys carried the jangling copper bowl past him, the thief-maker tossed a small leather purse into it, spread his arms wide, and bowed with his characteristic serpentine theatricality. The last Locke saw of him, he was moving rapidly across the temple district with his crooked arms and bony shoulders rolling gaily, the strut of a man set free. 9. The sanctuary of the Temple of Perelandro was a musty stone chamber with several puddles of standing water. The mould-eaten tapestries on the walls were rapidly devolving into their component threads. It was lit only by the pastel glare of false light and the half-hearted efforts of a frosted white alchemical globe perched precariously in a fixture just above the steel plate that chained the eyeless priest to the sanctuary wall. Locke saw a curtained doorway on the back wall and nothing else.
Carlo, Galdo, said Father Chains. Be good lads and see to the doors, will you?
The two robed boys set down the copper kettle and moved to one of the tapestries. Working together, they swept it aside and pulled at a concealed device. Some great mechanism creaked in the sanctuary walls, and the twin doors leading out to the temple steps began to draw inward. When they finished sliding together with the scrape of stone against stone, the alchemical globe suddenly flared into brighter luminescence.
Now,
said the eyeless priest as he knelt, letting a great deal of slack chain gather in little steel mounds about him.
Come over here, Locke Lamora, and let's see if you have any of the gifts necessary to become an initiate of this temple.
With Father Chains on his knees, Locke and he were roughly forehead to forehead. In response to Chains' beckoning hands, Locke stepped close and waited. The priest wrinkled his nose.
I see that your former master remains less than fastidious about the pungency of his wards. No matter, that will soon be rectified. For now, simply give me your hands, like so.
Chains firmly but gently guided Locke's small hands until the boy's palms rested over Chains' blindfold.
Now, merely close your eyes and concentrate. Concentrate. Let whatever virtuous thoughts you have within you bubble to the surface. Let the warmth of your generous spirit flow forth from your innocent hands. Ah, yes, like that.
Locke was half alarmed and half amused, but the lines of Father Chain's weathered face drew downward, and his mouth soon hung open in beatific anticipation.
Ah,
the priest whispered, his voice thick with emotion.
Yes, yes, you do have some talent, some power. I can feel it. It might almost be a miracle!
At that, Chains jerked his head back, and Locke jumped in the opposite direction. His chains clanking, the priest lifted manacled hands to his blindfold and yanked it off with a flourish. Locke recoiled, unsure of what eyeless sockets might look like, but the priest's eyes were quite normal. In fact, Chains squinted in pain and rubbed them several times, wincing at the glare of the alchemical globe.
Ah! Ha! Ha! Ha!
He cried, finally holding out his hands toward Locke.
I'm healed! I can see once more!
Locke stared, gaping like a slackwit for the second time that night, unsure of what to say. Behind him, the two hooded boys started to giggle, and Locke's eyebrows bent inward in suspicion.
You're not really blind, he said.
And you're clearly not stupid,
Chains cried, leaping up with a glee that brought wet-sounding pops from his kneecaps. He waved his manacled hands like a bird trying to take flight.
Carlo, Galdo, get these damned things off my wrists so we can count our daily blessings.
The two hooded boys hurried over and did something to the manacles that Locke couldn't quite follow. They slid open and fell to the floor with a jarring clatter. Chains gingerly rubbed the skin that had been beneath them. It was as white as the meat of a fresh fish.
You're not really a priest,
Locke added, while the older man caressed some colour back into his forearms.
Oh, no, Chains said. I am a priest, just not a priest of Perelandro. Nor are my initiates initiates of Perelandro, nor will you be an initiate of Perelandro. Locke Lamora, say hello to Carlo and Galdo Sansa.
The white-robed boys swept back their hoods, and Locke saw that they were twins, perhaps a year or two older than himself and far sturdier looking. They had the olive skin and black hair of the true Camorri. Their identical long, hook-ended noses, however, were something of an anomaly. Smiling, they joined hands and bowed in unison from the waist.
Hi, Locke said. Which of you is which? Today I am Galdo, said the one on Locke's left. Tomorrow I will probably be Galdo, said the other one. Or perhaps we'll both want to be Carlo, added the one who had first spoken.
In time, Father Chains interrupted, you'll learn to tell them apart by the number of dents I've kicked in their respective asses. One of them always manages to be ahead of the other somehow.
He stood behind Locke and placed both of his wide, heavy hands on Locke's shoulders.
Idiots, this is Locke Lamora. As you can see, I've just bought him from your old benefactor, the Master of Shades Hill.
We remember you, said presumed Galdo. A catchfire orphan, said presumed Carlo. Father Chains bought us just after you arrived, they said in unison, grinning.
Knock that bullshit off,
Father Chains said, his voice somehow regal.
You two have just volunteered to cook dinner. Pears and sausage in oil, and a double portion for your new little brother. Get! Locke and I will deal with the kettle.
Sneering and gesturing rudely as they went, the twins ran for the curtained door and vanished behind it. Locke could hear their footsteps trailing away down some sort of staircase. Then Father Chains motioned for him to sit beside the copper money kettle.
Sit, boy. Let's have a few words about what's going on here.
Chains eased himself back down to the damp floor, crossing his legs and settling a thoughtful stare on Locke.
Your former masters said you could do simple sums. Is this true?
Yes, master.
Don't call me master. Makes my balls shrivel and my teeth crack. Just call me Father Chains, and while you're sitting there, let's see you tip that kettle and count all the money in there.
Locke strained to pull the kettle over on one side, seeing now why Carlo and Galdo preferred to share the burden. Chains gave the kettle a push on the base, and its contents finally spilled out on the floor beside Locke.
Makes it much harder to snatch, having it weigh that much, Chains said.
How can you pretend to be a priest?
Locke asked, while he sorted full copper coins and clipped copper bits into little piles.
Don't you fear the gods, the wrath of Perelandro?
Of course I do,
Chains replied, running his fingers through his round, ragged beard.
I fear them very much. Like I said, I'm a priest, just not a priest of Perelandro. I'm an initiated servant of the Nameless 13th, the Thief Watcher, the Crooked Warden, the Benefactor, Father of Necessary Pretexts.
But there are only the 12.
It's funny just how many people are sadly misinformed on that point, my dear boy. Imagine, if you will, that the 12 happen to have something of a black sheep younger brother, whose exclusive dominion happens to be thieves like you and I. Though the 12 won't allow his name to be spoken or heard, they have some lingering affection for his merry brand of fuckery. Thus, crooked old posers such as myself aren't blasted with lightning or pecked apart by crows for squatting in the temple of a more respectable god like Perelandro.
You're a priest of this 13th?
Indeed, a priest of thieves and a thieving priest, as Carlo and Galdo will be some day, and as you might be, provided you're worth even the pittance I paid for you.
But,
Locke reached out and plucked the thief-maker's purse, a pouch of rust-red leather, from the piles of copper and passed it to Chains.
If you paid for me, why did my old master leave an offering?
Ah, rest assured that I did pay for you, and you were cheap, and this is no offering.
Chains untied the little pouch and let its contents, a single white shark's tooth as long as Locke's thumb, drop into his hand. Chains waved it at the boy.
Have you ever seen one of these before?
No. What is it?
It's a death mark. The tooth of the wolf shark is the personal sigil of Kappa Barsavi, your former master's boss. My boss and your boss, for that matter. It means that you're such a sullen, thick-skulled little fuck-up that your former master actually went to the Kappa and got permission to kill you.
Chains grinned, as though he were imparting nothing more than a ribald joke. Locke shivered.
Does that give you a moment of pause, my boy? Good. Stare at this thing, Locke. Take a good hard look. It means your death is paid for. I bought this from your former master when I got you at a bargain price. It means that if Duke Nicovante himself adopted you tomorrow and proclaimed you his heir, I could still crack your skull open and nail you to a post, and nobody in the city would lift a fucking finger.
Chains deftly shoved the tooth back into the red pouch, then hung it around Locke's neck by its slender cord.
"You're going to wear that," the older man said, "until I deem you worthy to remove it, or until I make use of the power it gives me, and so."
He slashed two fingers across the air in front of Locke's throat.
"Hide it under your clothes, and keep it next to your skin at all times, to remind you just how close, how very close, you came to getting your throat slit tonight. If your former master were one shade less greedy than he is vindictive, I don't doubt you'd be floating in the bay."
"What did I do?"
Chains did something with his eyes that made Locke feel smaller just for having tried to protest. Locke squirmed and fiddled with the death mark pouch.
"Please, boy, let's not start out with either of us insulting the other's intelligence. There are only three people in life you can never fool: pawnbrokers, whores, and your mother. Since your mother's dead, I've taken her place. Hence, I'm bullshit-proof."
Chain's voice grew serious.
"You know perfectly well why your former master would have cause to be displeased with you."
"He said I wasn't circumspect."
"Circumspect," Chains repeated. "That's a good word. And no, you're not. He told me everything."
Locke looked up from his little piles of coins, his eyes wide and near watering.
"Everything?"
"Quite everything."
Chains stared the boy down for a long, difficult moment, then sighed.
"So what did the good citizens of Camor give to the cause of Perelandro today?"
27 copper barons, I think.
Just over 4 silver solons, then. A slow day, but it beats every other form of theft I ever met."
"You steal this money from Perelandro, too?"
"Of course I do, boy. I mentioned that I was a thief, didn't I? But not the sort of thief you're used to. Better. The entire city of Camor is full of idiots running around and getting hung, all because they think that stealing is something you do with your hands."
Father Chains spat.
What do you steal with, Father Chains?"
The bearded priest tapped two fingers against the side of his head, then grinned widely.
"Brains and a big mouth, my boy. Brains and a big mouth. I planted my ass here 13 years ago, and the pious suckers of Camor have been feeding me coins ever since. Plus, I'm famous from Emberlane to Tal Varar, which is pleasant, though mostly I like the cold coinage."
"Isn't it uncomfortable?"
Locke asked, looking around at the sad innards of the temple.
"Living here, never going out?"
Chains chuckled.
"This shabby little backstage is no more the full extent of my temple than your old home was really a graveyard. We're a different sort of thief here, Lamora.
Deception and misdirection are our tools. We don't believe in hard work when a false face and a good line of bullshit can do so much more.
Then you're like teasers.
Perhaps, in the sense that a barrel of fire oil is akin to a pinch of red pepper. And that's why I paid for you, my boy. Though you lack the good sense the gods gave a carrot, you lie like a floor tapestry. You're more crooked than an acrobat's spine. I could really make something of you if I decided I could trust you. His searching eyes rested once more on Locke, and the boy guessed that he was supposed to say something.
"I'd like that," he whispered. "What do I do?"
"You can start by talking. I want to hear about what you did at Shades Hill, the shit you pulled to get your former master angry at you."
"But you said you already knew everything."
"I do, but I want to hear it from you, plain and clear, and I want it right the first time, with no backtracking or parts left out. If you try to conceal anything that I know you should be mentioning, I'll have no choice but to consider you a worthless waste of my trust, and you're already wearing my response around your neck."
"Then where," said Locke, with only a slight catch in his voice, "do I start?"
"We can begin with your most recent transgressions. There's one law that the brothers and sisters of Shades Hill must never break. But your former master told me that you broke it twice and thought you were clever enough to get away with it." Locke's cheeks turned bright red, and he stared down at his fingers. "Tell me, Locke. The thief-maker said you arranged the murders of two other Shades Hill boys, and that he didn't pick up on your involvement until the second was already done." Chains steepled his fingers before his face and gazed calmly at the boy with the death mark around his neck.
"I want to know why you killed them, and I want to know how you killed them, and I want to hear it from your own lips right now."
Part 1. Ambition. Why, I can smile and murder whiles I smile, and cry content to that which grieves my heart, and wet my cheeks with artificial tears, and frame my face to all occasions. King Henry VI, Part 3. Chapter 1. The Don Salvara Game. 1. Locke Lamora's rule of thumb was this. A good confidence game took 3 months to plan, 3 weeks to rehearse, and 3 seconds to win or lose the victim's trust forever. This time around, he planned to spend those 3 seconds getting strangled. Locke was on his knees, and Carlo, standing behind him, had a hemp rope coiled 3 times around his neck. The rough stuff looked impressive, and it would leave Locke's throat a very credible shade of red. No genuine Camorri assassin old enough to waddle in a straight line would garrote with anything but silk or wire, of course, the better to crease the victim's windpipe. Yet if Don Lorenzo Salvara could tell a fake strangling from the real thing in the blink of an eye at 30 paces, they'd badly misjudge the man they planned to rob, and the whole game would be shot anyway.
"Can you see him yet, or bug's signal?"
Locke hissed his question as lightly as he could, then made a few impressive gurgling sounds.
"Now signal, now Don Salvara, can you breathe?" "Fine, just fine," Locke whispered. "But shake me some more. That's the convincer."
They were in the dead-end alley beside the old Temple of Fortunate Waters. The temple's prayer waterfalls could be heard gushing somewhere behind the high plaster wall. Locke clutched once again at the harmless coils of rope circling his neck and spared a glance for the horse staring at him from just a few paces away, laden down with a rich-looking cargo of merchants' packs. The poor dumb animal was gentled. There was neither curiosity nor fear behind the milk-white shells of its unblinking eyes. It wouldn't have cared even had the strangling been real. Precious seconds passed. The sun was high and bright in a sky scalded free of clouds,
and the grime of the alley clung like wet cement to the legs of Locke's breeches. Nearby, Jean Tannen lay in the same moist muck, while Galdo pretended, mostly, to kick his ribs in. He'd been merrily kicking away for at least a minute, just as long as his twin brother had supposedly been strangling Locke. Don Salvara was supposed to pass the mouth of the alley at any second, and, ideally, rush in to rescue Locke and Jean from their assailants. At this rate, he would end up rescuing them from boredom.
"Gods!" Carlo whispered, bending his mouth to Locke's ear, as though he might be hissing some demand. "Where the hell is that damned Salvara? And where's Bug? We can't keep this shit up all day. Other people do walk by the mouth of this damned alley." "Keep strangling me," Locke whispered. "Just think of 20,000 full crowns and keep strangling me. I can choke all day if I have to."
2. Everything had gone beautifully that morning in the run-up to the game itself, even allowing for the natural prickliness of a young thief finally allowed a part in his first big score.
"Of course I know where I'm supposed to be when the action starts,"
Bug whined.
"I've spent more time perched up on that temple roof than I did in my mother's goddamned womb."
Jean Tannen let his right hand trail in the warm water of the canal while he took another bite of the sour marsh apple held in his left. The forward gunwale of the flat-bottomed barge was a choice spot for relaxation in the watered wine light of early morning, allowing all 16 stone of Jean's frame to sprawl comfortably, keg belly, heavy arms, bandy legs, and all. The only other person, and the one doing all the work, in the empty barge was Bug, a lanky, mop-headed 12-year-old braced against the steering pole at the stern. "Your mother was in an understandable hurry to get rid of you, Bug." Jean's voice was soft and even and wildly incongruous. He spoke like a teacher of music or a copier of scrolls. "Where not? So indulge me once more with proof of your penetrating comprehension of our game."
"Damn it,"
Bug replied, giving the barge another push against the gentle current of the seaward flowing canal.
"You and Locke and Carlo and Galdo are down in the alley between Fortunate Waters and the gardens of the Temple of Nara, right? I'm up on the roof of the temple across the way."
"Go on," Jean said around a mouthful of marsh apple. "Where's Don Salvara?" Other barges, heavily laden with everything from ale casks to bleating cows, were slipping past the two of them on the clay-coloured water of the canal. Bug was poling them north along Camor's main commercial waterway, the Via Camorazza, toward the shifting market, and the city was lurching into life around them. The leaning grey tenements of water-slick stone were spitting their inhabitants out into the sunlight and the rising summer warmth. The month was Parthis, meaning that the night sweat of condensation already boiling off the buildings as a soupy mist would be greatly missed by the cloudless white heat of early afternoon.
"He's coming out of the Temple of Fortunate Waters, like he does every penance day right around noon. He's got two horses and one man with him, if we're lucky."
"A curious ritual," Jean said. "Why would he do a thing like that?"
"Deathbed promise to his mother."
Bug drove his pole down into the canal, struggled against it for a moment, and managed to shove them along once more.
"She kept the Vadran religion after she married the old Don Salvara, so he leaves an offering at the Vadran temple once a week and gets home as fast as he can so nobody pays too much attention to him. Damn it, Jean, I already know this shit. Why would I be here if you didn't trust me? And why am I the one who gets to push this stupid barge all the way to the market?"
"Oh, you can stop poling the barge any time you can beat me hand to hand 3 falls out of 5. Jean grinned, showing 2 rows of crooked brawler's teeth in a face that looked as though someone had set it on an anvil and tried to pound it into a more pleasing shape. "Besides, you're an apprentice in a proud trade, learning under the finest and most demanding masters it has to offer. Getting all the shit work is excellent for your moral education."
"You haven't given me any bloody moral education."
"Yes, Well, that's probably because Locke and I have been dodging our own for most of our lives now. As for why we're going over the plan again, let me remind you that one good screw-up will make the fate of those poor bastards look sunny in comparison to what we'll get. Jean pointed at one of the city's slop wagons, halted on a canal-side boulevard to receive a long, dark stream of night soil from the upper window of a public alehouse. These wagons were crewed by petty criminals whose offences were too meagre to justify continual incarceration in the Palace of Patience. Shackled to their wagons and huddled in the alleged protection of long leather ponchos, they were let out each morning to enjoy what sun they could when they weren't cursing the dubious accuracy with which several thousand Camorri emptied their chamber pots.
"I won't screw it up, Jean."
Bug shook his thoughts like an empty coin purse, searching desperately for something to say that would make him sound as calm and assured as he imagined Jean and all the older gentleman bastards always were. But the mouth of most 12-year-olds far outpaces the mind.
"I just won't. I bloody won't. I promise."
"Good lad," Jean said. "Glad to hear it. But just what is it that you won't screw up?" Bug sighed.
"I make the signal when Salvara's on his way out of the Temple of Fortunate Waters. I keep an eye out for anyone else trying to walk past the alley, especially the city watch. If anybody tries it, I jump down from the temple roof with a long sword and cut their bloody heads off where they stand."
"You what?"
"I said I distract them any way I can. You going deaf, Jean?"
A line of tall counting houses slid past on their left, each displaying lacquered woodwork, silk awnings, marble facades, and other ostentatious touches along the waterfront. There were deep roots of money and power sunk into that row of 3- and 4-story buildings. Coin Kisser's Row was the oldest and goldest financial district on the continent. The place was as steeped in influence and elaborate rituals as the glass heights of the Five Towers, in which the Duke and the grand families sequestered themselves from the city they ruled. "Move us up against the bank just under the bridges, Bug." Jean gestured vaguely with his apple. "His nibs will be waiting to come aboard." 2 elder glass arches bridged the Via Camorazza right in the middle of Coin Kisser's Row, a high and narrow cat bridge for foot traffic and a lower, wider one for wagons. The seamless brilliance of the alien glass looked like nothing so much as liquid diamond, gently arched by giant hands and left to harden over the canal. On the right bank was the Fauna, a crowded island of multi-tiered stone apartments and rooftop gardens. Wooden wheels churned white against the stone embankment, drawing canal water up into a network of troughs and viaducts that crisscrossed over the Fauna's streets at every level. Bug slid the barge over to a rickety quay just beneath the cat bridge. From the faint and slender shadow of this arch, a man jumped down to the quay, dressed, as Bug and Jean were, in oil-stained leather breeches and a rough cotton shirt. His next nonchalant leap took him into the barge, which barely rocked at his arrival.
"Salutations to you, Master Jean Tannen, and profuse congratulations on the fortuitous timing of your arrival," said the newcomer.
"Ah, well, felicitations to you in respect of the superlative grace of your entry into our very humble boat, Master Lamora." Jean punctuated this statement by popping the remains of his apple into his mouth, stem and all, and producing a wet crunching noise.
"Creeping shit, man!" Locke Lamora stuck out his tongue. "Must you do that? You know the black alchemists make fish poison from the seeds of those damned things."
"Lucky me," said Jean, after swallowing the last bit of masticated pulp, "not being a fish." Locke was a medium man in every respect. Medium height, medium build, medium dark hair, cropped short above a face that was neither handsome nor memorable. He looked like a proper Therin, though perhaps a bit less olive and ruddy than Jean or Bug. In another light, he might have passed for a very tan Vadran. His bright grey eyes alone had any sense of distinction. He was a man the gods might have shaped deliberately to be overlooked. He settled down against the left-hand gunwale and crossed his legs.
Hello to you as well, Bug. I knew we could count on you to take pity on your elders and let them rest in the sun while you do the hard work with the pole.
Jean's a lazy old bastard is what it is, Bug said. And if I don't pole the barge, he'll knock my teeth out the back of my head. Jean is the gentlest soul in Camorre, and you wound him with your accusations, said Locke. Now he'll be up all night crying.
I would have been up all night anyway, Jean added, crying from the ache of rheumatism and lighting candles to ward off evil vapours.
Which is not to say that our bones don't creak by day, my cruel apprentice.
Locke massaged his kneecaps.
We're at least twice your age, which is prodigious for our profession.
The daughters of Azaguia have tried to perform a corpse blessing on me 6 times this week, said Jean. You're lucky Locke and I are still spry enough to take you with us when we run a game. To anyone beyond hearing range, Locke and Jean and Bug might have looked like the crew of a for-hire barge, slacking their way toward a cargo pickup at the junction of the Via Camarazza and the Angevin River. As Bug poled them closer and closer to the shifting market, the water was getting thicker with such barges, and with sleek black cockle-shell boats and battered watercraft of every description, not all of them doing a good job of staying afloat or under control.
"Speaking of our game," said Locke, "how is our eager young apprentice's understanding of his place in the scheme of things?" "I've been reciting it to Jean all morning," said Bug.
"And the conclusion is?"
"I've got it down cold!"
Bug heaved at the pole with all of his strength, driving them between a pair of high-walled floating gardens with inches to spare on either side. The scents of jasmine and oranges drifted down over them as their barge slipped beneath the protruding branches of one of the gardens. A wary attendant peeked over one garden boat's wall, staff in hand to fend them off if necessary. The big barges were probably hauling transplants to some noble's orchard upriver.
"Down cold, and I won't screw it up. I promise. I know my place, and I know the signals. I won't screw it up."
3. Carlo was shaking Locke with real vigour, and Locke's performance as his victim was a virtuoso one, but still the moments dragged by. They were all trapped in their pantomime like figures out of the richly inventive hells of Therin theology. A pair of thieves destined to spend all eternity stuck in an alley, mugging victims that never passed out or gave up their money.
"Are you as alarmed as I am?"
Carlo whispered.
"Just stay in character," Locke hissed. "You can pray and strangle at the same time."
There was a high-pitched scream from their right, echoing across the cobbles and walls of the temple district. It was followed by shouts and the creaking tread of men in battle harness, but these sounds moved away from the mouth of the alley, not toward it.
"That sounds like Bug," said Locke. "I hope he's just arranging a distraction," said Carlo, his grip on the rope momentarily slackening.
At that instant, a dark shape darted across the gap of sky between the alley's high walls, its fluttering shadow briefly falling over them as it passed.
"Now what the hell was that, then?" Carlo asked.
Off to their right, someone screamed again. 4. Bug had pulled himself, Locke, and Jean from the Via Camarazza into the shifting market right on schedule, just as the vast elderglass wind chime atop Westwatch was unlashed to catch the breeze blowing in from the sea and ring out the 11th hour of the morning. The shifting market was a lake of relatively placid water at the very heart of Camorre, perhaps half a mile in circumference, protected from the rushing flow of the Angevin and the surrounding canals by a series of stone breakwaters. The only real current in the market was human-made, as hundreds upon hundreds of floating merchants slowly and warily followed one another counterclockwise in their boats, jostling for prized positions against the flat-topped breakwaters, which were crowded with buyers and sightseers on foot. City watchmen in their mustard-yellow tabards commanded sleek black cutters, each rowed by a dozen shackled prisoners from the Palace of Patience, using long poles and harsh language to maintain several rough channels through the drifting chaos of the market. Through these channels passed the pleasure barges of the nobility, and heavily laden freight barges, and empty ones like that containing the three gentlemen bastards, who shopped with their eyes as they sliced through a sea of hope and avarice. In just a few lengths of Bug's poling, they passed a family of trinket dealers in ill-kept brown cockle-shells, a spice merchant and his wares on a triangular rack in the middle of an awkward circular raft of the sort called a vertola, and a canal tree bobbing and swaying in the leather bladder pontoon raft that supported its roots. These roots trailed in the water, drinking up the piss and effluvia of the busy city. The canopy of rustling emerald leaves cast thousands of punctuated shadows down on the gentlemen bastards as they passed, along with the perfume of citrus. The tree, an alchemical hybrid that grew both limes and lemons, was tended by a middle-aged woman and three small children, who scuttled around in the branches, throwing down fruit in response to orders from passing boats. Above the watercraft of the shifting market rose a field of flags and pennants and billowing silk standards, all competing through gaudy colours and symbols to impress their messages on watchful buyers. There were flags adorned with the crude outlines of fish or fowl or both, flags adorned with ale mugs and wine bottles and loaves of bread, boots and trousers and threaded tailor's needles, fruits and kitchen instruments and carpenter's tools and 100 other goods and services. Here and there small clusters of chicken-flagged boats or shoe-flagged rafts were locked in close combat, their owners loudly proclaiming the superiority of their respective goods or inferring the bastardy of one another's children, while the watchboats stood off at a mindful distance, in case anyone should sink or commence a boarding action. "It's a pain sometimes, this pretending to be poor." Locke gazed around in reverie, the sort Bug would have been indulging in if the boy hadn't been concentrating on avoiding collision. A barge packed with dozens of yowling house-cats in wooden slat cages cut their wake, flagged with a blue pennant on which an artfully rendered dead mouse bled rich scarlet threads through a gaping hole in its throat. "There's just something about this place. I could almost convince myself that I really did have a pressing need for a pound of fish, some bowstrings, old shoes, and a new shovel."
"Fortunately for our credibility," said Jean, "we're coming up on the next major landmark on our way to a fat pile of Don Salvara's money."
He pointed past the northeastern breakwater of the market, beyond which a row of prosperous-looking waterfront inns and taverns stood between the market and the temple district.
"Right as always, Jean. Greed before imagination. Keep us on track,"
Locke added an enthusiastic but superfluous finger to the direction Jean was already pointing.
"Bug! Get us out onto the river, then veer right. One of the twins is going to be waiting for us at the tumble home, third in down on the south bank."
Bug pushed them north, straining to reach the bottom of the market's basin, which was easily half again as deep as the surrounding canals, with each thrust. They evaded overzealous purveyors of grapefruits and sausage rolls and alchemical light sticks, and Locke and Jean amused themselves with a favourite game, trying to spot the little pickpockets among the crowds on the breakwaters. The inattention of Camor's busy thousands still managed to feed the doddering old thief-maker in his dank warren under Shades Hill, nearly 20 years since Locke or Jean had last set foot inside the place. Once they escaped from the market and onto the river itself, Bug and Jean wordlessly switched places. The fast waters of the Angevine would be better matched against Jean's muscle, and Bug would need to rest his arms for his part in the game to come. As Bug collapsed in Jean's former place at the bow, Locke produced a cinnamon lemon, apparently from thin air, and tossed it to the boy. Bug ate it in 6 bites, dry skin and all, masticating the reddish-yellow pulp as grotesquely as possible between his bright, crooked teeth. He grinned.
"They don't make fish poison from those things, right?"
"No," Locke said. "They only make fish poison from things that Jean eats." Jean harumphed.
A little fish poison puts hair on your chest, excepting if you're a fish.
Jean kept them nearly against the southern bank of the Angevine, clear of the depths where the pole couldn't reach. Shafts of hot pearl-white light flashed down on them as elderglass bridges passed directly between their barge and the still-rising sun. The river was 200 yards wide, sweating its wetness up into the air along with the smell of fish and silt. To the north, rippling under the heat haze, were the orderly slopes of the Alcigrante Islands, home to the city's greater commoners and minor nobles. It was a place of walled gardens, elaborate water sculptures, and white stone villas, well off limits to anyone dressed as Locke and Jean and Bug were. With the sun approaching its zenith, the vast shadows of the five towers had withdrawn into the upper city and were currently nothing more than a rosy stained glass glow that spilled just over the northern edges of the Alcigrante.
"Gods, I love this place," Locke said, drumming his fingers against his thighs. "Sometimes I think this whole city was put here simply because the gods must adore crime. Pickpockets rob the common folk, merchants rob anyone they can dupe. Kappa Barsavi robs the robbers and the common folk, the lesser nobles rob nearly everyone, and Duke Nicovante occasionally runs off with his army and robs the shit out of Tal Verar or Jerem, not to mention what he does to his own nobles and his common folk."
"So that makes us robbers of robbers," said Bug, "who pretend to be robbers working for a robber of other robbers. Yes, we do sort of screw the pretty picture up, don't we?"
Locke thought for a few seconds, clicking his tongue against the insides of his cheeks.
"Think of what we do as a sort of secret tax on nobles with more money than prudence. Hey, here we are."
Beneath the Tumbleholme Inn was a wide and well-kept quay with half a dozen mooring posts, none of them currently occupied. The smooth grey embankment was about 10 feet high here. Broad stone steps led up to street level, as did a cobbled ramp for cargo and horses. Carlo Sanza was waiting for them at the edge of the quay, dressed only slightly better than his fellows, with a gentled horse standing placidly behind him. Locke waved.
"What's the news?"
Locke cried. Jean's poling was skillful and graceful. The quay was 20 yards away, then 10, and then they were sliding up alongside it with a gentle scraping noise.
"Galdo got all the stuff packed into the room. It's the bowsprit suite on the first floor,"
Carlo whispered in response, bending down to Locke and Bug as he picked up the barge's mooring rope. Carlo had dark liquor-coloured skin and hair like an inky slice of night. The tautness of the flesh around his dark eyes was broken only by a fine network of laugh lines, though anyone who knew the Sanza twins would more readily describe them as smirk lines. An improbably sharp and hooked nose preceded his good looks like a dagger held at guard position. Once he had made the barge fast to a mooring post, Carlo tossed to Locke a heavy iron key attached to a long tassel of braided red and black silk. At a quality rooming house like the Tumbleholme, each private suite's door was guarded by a clockwork lockbox, removable only by some cunning means known to the owners, that could be swapped out from a niche in the door. Each rented room received a random new box and its attendant key. With hundreds of such identical-looking boxes stored behind the polished counter in the reception hall, the inn could pretty much guarantee that copying keys for later break-ins was a practical waste of a thief's time. This courtesy would also give Locke and Jean guaranteed privacy for the rapid transformation that was about to take place.
"Wonderful!"
Locke leapt up onto the quay as spryly as he had entered the boat. Jean passed the steering pole back to Bug, then made the barge shudder with his own leap.
"Let's go on in and fetch out our guests from Emberlane."
As Locke and Jean padded up the steps toward the Tumbleholme, Carlo motioned for Bug to give him a hand with the horse. The white-eyed creature was utterly without fear or personal initiative, but that same lack of self-preservation instincts might lead it to damage the barge very easily. After a few minutes of careful pushing and pulling, they had it positioned in the center of the barge, as calm as a statue that just happened to have lungs.
"Lovely creature," said Carlo. "I've named him Impediment. You could use him as a table or a flying buttress."
"Gentled animals, give me the bloody creeps."
"Whereas," said Carlo, "they give me the fucking creeps. But tenderfoots and softies prefer gentled pack horses, and that's our master merchant of Emberlane in a nutshell."
Several more minutes passed, and Carlo and Bug stood in amiable silence under the punishing sun, looking the part of an unremarkable barge crew waiting to receive a passenger of consequence from the bosom of the Tumbleholme Inn. Soon enough, that passenger descended the stairs and coughed twice to get their attention. It was Locke, of course, but changed. His hair was slicked back with rose oil. The bones of his face seemed to shadow slightly deeper hollows in his cheeks, and his eyes were half concealed behind a pair of optics rimmed with black pearl and flashing silver in the sun. He was now dressed in a tightly buttoned black coat in the Emberlane style, almost form-fitted from his shoulders down to his ribs, then flaring out widely at the waist. Two black leather belts with polished silver buckles circled his stomach. Three ruffled layers of black silk cravats poured out of his collar and fluttered in the hot breeze. He wore embroidered grey hose over thick-heeled sharkskin shoes with black ribbon tongues that sprang somewhat ludicrously outward and hung over his feet with the drooping curl of hothouse flowers. Sweat was already beading on his forehead like little diamonds. Camor's summer did not reward the intrusion of fashions from a more northerly climate.
"My name," said Locke Lamora, "is Lucas Fairwhite."
The voice was clipped and precise, scrubbed of Locke's natural inflections. He layered the hint of a harsh Vajran accent atop a slight mangling of his native Camori dialect, like a barkeep mixing liquors.
"I am wearing clothes that will be full of sweat in several minutes. I am dumb enough to walk around Camor without a blade of any sort. Also," he said, with a hint of ponderous regret, "I am entirely fictional."
"I'm very sorry to hear that, Master Fairwhite," said Carlo, "but at least we've got your boat and your horse ready for your grand excursion."
Locke stepped carefully down toward the edge of the barge, swaying at the hips like a man newly off a ship and not yet used to surfaces that didn't tilt beneath his feet. His spine was arrow straight, his movements nearly prissy. He wore the mannerisms of Lucas Fairwhite like a set of invisible clothes.
"My attendant will be along any moment," Locke Fairwhite said, as they
stepped aboard the barge.
"His name is Grauman, and he too suffers from a slight case of being imaginary."
"Merciful gods," said Carlo. "It must be catching."
Down the cobbled ramp came Jean, treading heavily under the weight of 120 pounds of creaking horse's harness, the embroidered leather packs crammed full of goods and strapped tightly shut. Jean now wore a white silk shirt, straining tight against his belly, and already translucent in places with sweat, under an open black vest and a white neckerchief. His hair was parted in the middle, and held in stasis by some thick black oil. Never picturesque, it now resembled two pads of wool arched over his forehead like a tenement roof.
"We're behind schedule, Grauman!"
Locke clasped his hands behind his back.
"Do hurry up and let the poor horse do its job!"
Jean heaved his mess over the gentled horse's back, to no visible reaction from the animal. He then bent down and fastened the harness securely under the horse's stomach. Bug passed the steering pole to Carlo, then slipped the barge's rope from the mooring post, and they were off once again.
"Wouldn't it be damned amusing," said Carlo, "if Don Salvara picked day to dodge out on his little ritual?"
"Don't worry," said Locke, briefly dropping the voice, if not the posture, of Lucas Fairwhite. "He's quite devoted to his mother's memory. A conscience can be as good as a water clock when it comes to keeping some appointments."
"From your lips to the god's ears,"
Carlo worked the pole with cheerful ease,
"and no skin off my balls if you're wrong.
You're the one wearing a 10-pound black felt coat in the middle of Parthis.
They made headway up the Angevine and came abreast with the western edge of the temple district on their right, passing beneath a wide glass arch as they did so. Standing atop the middle of this bridge was a lean, dark-haired man with looks and a nose to match Carlo's. As Carlo poled the barge underneath the arch some 50 feet below, Galdo Sansa casually let a half-eaten red apple fall from his hands. The fruit hit the water with a quiet little splash, just a yard or two behind his brother.
"Salvara's at the temple," Bug said.
"Sublime." Locke spread his hands and grinned. "Didn't I tell you he suffered from an impeccable sense of maternal devotion?"
"I'm so pleased that you only choose victims of the highest moral quality," said Carlo. "The wrong sort might set a bad example for Bug."
At a public dock jutting from the northwestern shore of the temple district, just under the heights of the city's vast new house of Iono, Father of Storms, Lord of the Grasping Waters, Jean tied them up in record time and led Impediment, looking every bit the part of a wealthy merchant's packhorse, up off the barge. Locke followed with Fairwright's nervous dignity on full display. All the banter was now banked down like coals under a cook fire. Bug darted off into the crowds, eager to take up his watch position over the alley junction where Don Salvara's ambitions would soon be sorely tempted. Carlo spotted Galdo just stepping off the glass bridge and casually moved toward him. Both twins were unconsciously fingering the weapons concealed beneath their baggy shirts. By the time the Sansa brothers fell into step beside one another and began moving toward the rendezvous at the Temple of Fortunate Waters, Locke and Jean were already a block away, approaching from another direction. The game was afoot. For the fourth time in as many years, in quiet defiance of the most inviolate law of Camor's underworld, the gentlemen bastards were drawing a bead on one of the most powerful men in the city. They were headed for a meeting that might eventually divest Don Lorenzo Salvara of nearly half his worldly wealth. Now everything depended on the Don being punctual. 5. Bug was in a perfect position to spot the foot patrol before anyone else did, which was according to the plan. The foot patrol itself was also in the plan, after a fashion. It meant the plan was blown.
"You're going to be top eyes on this game, Bug," Locke had explained. "We're deliberately making first touch on Salvara on the most deserted street in the Temple District. A spotter on the ground would be obvious a mile away, but a boy 2 stories up is another matter."
"What am I spotting for?"
"Whatever shows up. Duke Nicovante and the Nightglass Company, the King of the Seven Marrows, a little old lady with a dung wagon. If we get interlopers, you just make the signal. Maybe you can distract common folk. If it's the watch, well, we can either play innocent or run like hell."
And here were 6 men in mustard yellow tabards and well-oiled fighting harness, with batons and blades clattering ominously against their doubled waist belts, strolling up from the south just a few dozen paces away from the Temple of Fortunate Waters. Their path would take them right past the mouth of the all-important alley. Even if Bug warned the others in time for them to hide Carlo's rope, Locke and Jean would still be covered in mud, and the twins would still be, purposely, dressed like stage show bandits, complete with neckerchiefs over their faces. No chance to play innocent. If Bug gave the signal, it was run like hell time. Bug thought as fast as he ever had in his life, while his heart beat so rapidly it felt like someone was fluttering the pages of a book against the back of his lungs. He had to force himself to stay cool, stay observant, look for an opening. What was it Locke was always saying? Catalogue. He needed to catalogue his options. His options stank. 12 years old, crouched 20 feet up in the periphery of the wildly overgrown rooftop garden of a disused temple, with no long-range weapons and no other suitable distractions available. Don Salvara was still paying his respects to his mother's gods within the Temple of Fortunate Waters, and the only people in sight were his fellow gentlemen bastards and the sweat-soaked patrol about to ruin their day. But 20 feet down and 6 feet to Bug's right, against the wall of the crumbling structure on which he squatted, there was a rubbish pile. It looked like mould-eaten burlap sacks and a mixed assortment of brown muck. The prudent thing to do would be to signal the others and let them scurry. Carlo and Galdo were old hands at playing hard to get with the Yellow Jackets, and they could just come back and restart the game again next week. Maybe. Or maybe a screwed-up game today would alarm someone and lead to more foot patrols in the coming weeks. Maybe word would get around that the Temple District wasn't as quiet as it should be. Maybe Kappa Barsavi, beset by problems as he was, would take an interest in the unauthorized disturbance and turn his own screws. And then Don Salvara's money might as well be on the bloody moons, for all that the gentleman bastards could get their hands on it. No, prudence was out. Bug had to win. The presence of that rubbish pile made a great and glorious stupidity very possible. He was in the air before another thought crossed his mind. Arms out, falling backward, staring up into the hot near-noon sky with the confident assurance of all 12 of his years that death and injury were things reserved solely for people that weren't Bug. He screamed as he fell, in wild exultation, just to be sure that he had the foot patrol's unwavering attention. He could feel the great vast shadow of the ground looming up beneath him in the last half-second of his fall, and at that instant his eyes caught a dark shape cutting through the air just above the Temple of Fortunate Waters. A sleek and beautiful shape, heavy. A bird? A gull of some sort? Camor had no other birds that size. Certainly none that moved like crossbow bolts, and impact with the semi-yielding surface of the rubbish heap walloped the air out of his lungs with a wet whoosh and snapped his head forward. Sharp chin bounced off slender chest, his teeth punched bloody holes in his tongue, and the warm taste of salt filled his mouth. He screamed again, reflexively, and spat blood. His view of the sky spun first left, then right, as though the world were trying on strange new angles for his approval. Booted feet running on cobblestones, the creak and rattle of weapons in harness, a ruddy middle-aged face with two drooping sweat-slicked moustaches inserted itself between Bug and the sky.
"Perelandro's balls, boy!"
The watchman looked as bewildered as he did worried.
"What the hell were you doing screwing around up there? You're lucky you landed where you did!"
There were enthusiastic murmurs of agreement from the yellow-jacketed squad crowding in behind the first man. Bug could smell their sweat and their harness oil, as well as the rotten stench of the stuff that had broken his fall. Well, when you jumped into a street-side pile of brown glop in Camor, you knew going in that it wouldn't smell like rosewater. Bug shook his head to clear the white sparks dancing behind his eyes, and twitched his legs to be sure they would serve. Nothing appeared to be broken, thank the gods. He would re-evaluate his own claims on immortality when all of this was over.
"Watch, Sergeant!"
Bug hissed thickly, letting more blood spill out over his lips. Damn, his tongue burned with pain.
"Watch, Sergeant!"
"Yes?"
The man's eyes were going wider.
"Can you move your arms and legs, boy? What can you feel?"
Bug reached up with his hands, casually, not entirely feigning shakiness, and clutched at the watch sergeant's harness as though to steady himself.
"Watch, Sergeant,"
Bug said a few seconds later.
"Your purse is much lighter than it should be. Out whoring last night, were we?"
He shook the little leather pouch just under the watch sergeant's dark moustaches, and the larcenous part of his soul, which was, let us be honest, its majority, glowed warmly at the sheer befuddlement that blossomed in the man's eyes. For a split second, the pain of Bug's imperfect landing in the rubbish heap was forgotten. Then his other hand came up, as if by magic, and his orphan's twist hit the watch sergeant right between the eyes. An orphan's twist, or a little red keeper, was a weighted sack like a miniature cosh, kept hidden in clothes, but never against naked skin. It was traditionally packed full of ground shavings from a dozen of Camor's more popular hot peppers, and a few nasty cast-offs from certain black alchemists' shops.
No use against a real threat, but just the thing for another street urchin, or a certain sort of adult with wandering hands. Or an unprotected face at spitting distance. Bug was already rolling to his left, so the spray of fine, rust-coloured powder that erupted from his twist missed him by inches. The watch sergeant was not so lucky. It was a solid hit, scattering the hellish hot stuff up his nose, down his mouth, and straight into his eyes. He choked out a string of truly amazing wet bellows and fell backward, clawing at his cheeks. Bug was already up and moving with the giddy elasticity of youth. Even his bitterly aching tongue was temporarily forgotten in the all-consuming need to run like hell. Now he definitely had the foot patrol's undivided attention. They were shouting and leaping after him as his little feet pounded the cobbles and he sucked in deep, stinging gulps of humid air. He'd done his part to keep the game alive. It could now go on without him while he gave the Duke's constables their afternoon exercise. A particularly fast-thinking watchman fumbled his whistle into his mouth and blew it raggedly while still running. Three short bursts, a pause, then three more. Watchman down. Oh, shit. That would bring every yellow jacket in half the city at a dead run, weapons out. That would bring crossbows. It was suddenly deadly important that Bug slip the squad at his heels before other squads started sending spotters up onto roofs. His anticipation of a merry chase vanished. He had perhaps a minute and a half to get to one of his usual cozy holes and pull a vanish. Suddenly, his tongue hurt very badly indeed. 6. Don Lorenzo Salvara stepped out of the temple portico into the stark, bright dampness of high Camori noon, little imagining the education a certain boy thief was receiving in the concept of too clever by half just across the district. The trilling of watch whistles sounded faintly. Salvara narrowed his eyes and peered with some curiosity at the distant figure of a lone city watchman, stumbling across the cobbles and occasionally bouncing off walls, clutching his head as though afraid it was going to float off his neck and up into the sky.
"Can you believe it, my lord?"
Conte had already brought the horses around from the temple's unobtrusive little stabling grotto.
"Drunk as a baby in a beer barrel, and not a heartbeat past noon. Fucking pissant lot of softies, these new golden rods."
Conte was a sun-wrinkled man of middle years, with the waistline of a professional dancer and the arms of a professional oarsman. The manner in which he served the young Don was obvious even without a glance at the pair of thigh-length stilettos hanging from his crossed leather belts.
"Hardly up to your old standards, eh?"
The Don, on the other hand, was a well-favoured young man of the classic Camori blood, black-haired, with skin like shadowed honey. His face was heavy and soft with curves, though his body was slender, and only his eyes gave any hint that he wasn't a polite young collegium undergraduate masquerading as a noble. Behind his fashionable rimless optics, the Don had eyes like an impatient archer hungry for targets. Conte snorted.
"In my day, at least we knew that getting shit-faced was an indoor hobby."
Conte passed the Don the reins of his mount, a sleek grey mare little bigger than a pony, well-trained but certainly not gentled. Just the thing for short trots around a city still more friendly to boats, or acrobats, as Doña Salvara often complained, than to horses. The stumbling watchman vanished around a distant corner, vaguely in the direction of the urgent whistling. As it seemed to be coming no closer, Salvara shrugged inwardly, and led his horse out into the street. Here the day's second curiosity burst upon them in all of its glory. As the Don and his man turned to their right, they gained a full view of the high-walled alley beside the Temple of Fortunate Waters, and in this alley two finely dressed men were clearly getting their lives walloped out of them by a pair of bravos. Salvara froze and stared in wonder. Masked thugs in the temple district? Masked thugs strangling a man dressed all in black, in the tight, heavy, miserably inappropriate fashion of a Vardhan? And, merciful 12, a gentled pack horse was simply standing there, taking it all in.
After a handful of seconds lost to sheer amazement, the Don let his own horse's reins go and ran toward the mouth of the alley. He didn't need to glance sideways to know that Conte was barely astride behind him, knives out.
"You!"
The Don's voice was reasonably confident, though high with excitement.
"Unhand these men and stand clear!"
The closest footpad snapped his head around. His dark eyes widened above his improvised mask when he saw the Don and Conte approaching. The thug shifted his red-faced victim so that the man's body was between himself and the would-be interlopers.
"No need to trouble yourself with this business, my lord," the footpad said. "Just a bit of a disagreement. Private matter."
"Then perhaps you should have conducted it somewhere less public."
The footpad sounded quite exasperated.
"What? The Duke give you this alley to be your estate? Take another step, and I break this poor bastard's neck."
"You just do that."
Don Salvara settled his hand suggestively on the pommel of his basket-hilted rapier.
"My man and I appear to command the only way out of this alley. I'm sure you'll still feel quite pleased at having killed that man when you've got 3 feet of steel in your throat."
The first footpad didn't release his hold on the coiled loops of rope that were holding up his barely conscious victim, but he began to back off warily toward the dead end, dragging the black-clad man clumsily with him. His fellow thugs stood away from the prone form of the man he'd been savagely kicking. A meaningful look flashed between the two masked bandits.
"My friends, do not be stupid."
Salvara slid his rapier halfway out of its scabbard. Sunlight blazed white on finest Camorri steel, and Conte crouched forward on the balls of his feet, shifting to the predatory stance of a knife-fighter born and trained. Without another word, the first footpad flung his victim straight at Conte and the Don. While the unfortunate black-clad fellow gasped and clutched at his rescuers, the two masked thugs bolted for the wall at the rear of the alley. Conte sidestepped the heaving, shuddering Vardran and dashed after them, but the assailants were spry as well as cunning. A slim rope hung down the wall, barely visible, and knotted at regular intervals. The two thugs scrambled up this and all but dove over the top of the wall. Conte and his blades were 2 seconds too late. The weighted far end of the rope flew back over the wall and landed with a splat in the crusted muck at his feet.
"Fucking useless slug-a-bed bastards!"
The Don's man slid his stilettos back into his belt with easy familiarity and bent down to the heavy-set body lying unmoving in the muck. The eerie white stare of the gentled pack-horse seemed to follow him as he pressed fingers to the fat man's neck, seeking a pulse.
"Watchmen stumbling drunk in broad daylight, and look what happens in the bloody temple district while they screw around!" "Oh, thank the marrows!"
choked out the black-clad man as he uncoiled the rope from his neck and flung it to the ground. Don Salvara could now see that his clothes were very fine, despite their spattering of muck and their unseasonable weight, excellently cut, form-tailored, and ornamented with expensive subtlety rather than opulent flash.
"Thank the salt and thank the sweet! Thank the hands beneath the waters those bastards attacked us right beside this place of power, where the currents brought you to our aid!"
The man's theron was precise, though heavily accented, and his voice was unsurprisingly hoarse. He massaged his abraded throat, blinked, and began to pat the muck around him with his free hand, as though looking for something.
"I believe I can help you again,"
said Don Salvara in his best Vardran, which was as precise and as heavily accented as the stranger's theron. Salvara picked a pair of pearl-rimmed optics out of the muck, noting their light weight and sturdy construction, a superior and very expensive pair indeed, and wiped them off on the sleeve of his own loose scarlet coat before handing them to the man.
"And you speak Vardran?"
The stranger spoke in that tongue now, with the clipped, excitable diction of Emberlane. He slid the optics back over his eyes and blinked up at his rescuer.
"A complete miracle now! Far more than I have any right to pray for! Oh, Grauman!"
The black-clad Vardran scrambled unsteadily to his feet and stumbled over to his companion. Conte had managed to roll the portly stranger over in the slime. He now lay on his back, with his great muck-slick chest rising and falling steadily.
"He lives, obviously."
Conte slid his hands along the poor fellow's ribcage and stomach.
"I don't believe he has anything broken or ruptured, though he'll likely be green with bruises for weeks. Green as pond water, then black as night, or I don't know shit from custard tarts."
The slender, well-dressed Vardran let out a long sigh of relief.
"Custard tarts! Indeed! The marrows are most generous! Grauman is my attendant, my secretary, my diligent right hand. Alas, he has no skill at arms, but then I am myself plainly embarrassed in that regard."
The stranger now spoke Therin again, and he turned to stare at Don Salvara with wide eyes.
"Just as plainly I do you discourtesy, for you must be one of the dons of Camor."
He bowed low, lower even than etiquette would require of a landed foreigner greeting a peer of the serene duchy of Camor, almost until he was in danger of pitching forward on his chin.
"I am Lucas Fairwhite, servant to the House of Bel Oster, of the Canton of Emberlane and the Kingdom of the Seven Marrows. I am entirely at your service and grateful beyond words for what you have done for me today."
"I am a Lorenzo, Don Salvara, and this is my man Conte, and it is we who are entirely at your service without obligation."
The Don bowed at exactly the correct angle, with his right hand held out as an invitation to shake.
"I am in a sense responsible for Camor's hospitality, and what befell you here was not hospitality. It was upon my honour to come to your aid."
Fairwhite grasped the Don's proffered arm just above the wrist and shook. If Fairwhite's grasp was weak, the Don was willing to charitably ascribe it to his near strangling. Fairwhite then lowered his own forehead until it gently touched the back of the Don's hand, and their physical courtesies were settled.
"I beg to differ. You have here a sworn man, quite competent by his looks. You could have satisfied honour by sending him to our aid, yet you came yourself, ready to fight. From where I stood, it seemed he ran to keep up with you, and I assure you my viewpoint for this affair was uncomfortable but excellent."
The Don waved his hand gently, as though words could be swatted out of the air.
"I'm just sorry they got away, Master Fairwhite. It is unlikely that I can give you true justice. For that, Camor again apologizes."
Fairwhite knelt down beside Grauman and brushed the big man's sweat-slick dark hair back from his forehead.
"Justice? I am lucky to be alive. I was blessed with a safe journey here, and with your aid, I am alive to continue my mission, and that is justice enough."
The slender man looked up at Salvara again.
"Are you not Don Salvara of the Nakotsa Vineyards? Is not the Doña Sofia, the famous botanical alchemist, your wife?"
"I have that honour, and I have that pleasure," said the Don.
"And do you not serve the House of Bel Oster? Do you not deal with the,
Yes, oh yes, I serve that House of Bel Oster. My business is the sale and transport of the substance you're thinking of. It is curious, so very curious. The marrows toy with me. The hands beneath must wish me to drop dead of sheer wonder. That you should save my life here, that you should speak Vardran, that we should share a common business interest, it is uncanny."
"I, too, find it extraordinary, but hardly displeasing."
Don Salvara gazed around the alley thoughtfully.
"My mother was Vardran, which is why I speak the language enthusiastically, if poorly. Were you followed here? That rope over the wall bespeaks preparation, and the temple district... well, it's usually as safe as the Duke's own reading room."
"We arrived this morning," said Fairwhite, "after we secured our rooms, at the Inn of the Tumbleholm,
You know of it, I'm sure. We came straight here to give thanks and drown the offerings for our safe passage from Imberlane. I did not see where those men came from.
Fairwhite mused for a moment.
Though I believe that one of them threw that rope over the wall after knocking Grauman down. They were cautious, but not waiting in ambush for us.
Salvara grunted and turned his attention to the blank stare of the gentled horse.
Curious, do you always bring horses and goods to the temple to make your offerings? If those packs are as full as they look, I can see why thugs might have been tempted.
Ordinarily, such things would be under lock and key at our inn.
Fairwhite gave Grauman two friendly pats on the shoulder and rose again.
But for this cargo and for this mission, I must keep them with me at all times. And I fear that must have made us a tempting target. It is a conundrum.
Fairwhite scratched his chin slowly several times.
I am in your debt already, Don Lorenzo, and hesitant to ask aid of you once again. Yet this relates to the mission I am charged with for my time in Camor. As you are a Don, do you know of a certain Don Jacobo?
Don Salvara's eyes fixed firmly on Fairwhite, one corner of his mouth turned infinitesimally downward.
Yes, he said, and nothing more, after the silence had stretched a few moments.
This Don Jacobo, it is said that he is a man of wealth, extreme wealth, even for a Don.
That is true.
It is said that he is adventurous, bold even, that he has, how do you say it, an eye for strange opportunities, a toleration of risk.
That is one way of describing his character, perhaps?
Fairwhite licked his lips.
Don Lorenzo, it is important, if these things are true, could you, through your status as a peer of Camor, assist me in securing an appointment with Don Jacobo? I am ashamed to ask, but I would be more ashamed to forswear my mission for the House of Bel Oster.
Don Salvara smiled without the slightest hint of humour, and turned his head for several seconds, as though to gaze down at Grauman, lying quietly in the muck. Conte had stood up and was staring directly at his Don, eyes wide.
"Master Fairwhite," said the Don at last, "are you not aware that Paleri Jacobo is perhaps my greatest living enemy? That the two of us have fought to the blood twice, and only on the orders of Duke Nicovante himself do we not settle our affair for all time?"
"Oh," said Fairwhite, with the tone and facial expression of a man who has just dropped a torch in a hogshead cask of lamp oil. "How awkward! How stupid of me! I have done business in Camor several times, but I did not... I have insulted you. I have asked too much."
"Hardly."
Salvara's tone grew warm again. He began to drum the fingers of his right hand against the hilt of his rapier.
"But you're here on a mission for the House of Bel Oster. You carry a cargo that you refuse to let out of your sight. You clearly have your plan fixed upon Don Jacobo in some fashion, though you still need to gain a formal audience with him. So, to be clear, he doesn't know you're here, or that you plan on seeking him out, does he?"
I fear to say too much of my business."
"Yet your business here is plain," said Don Salvara, now positively cheerful. "And have you not repeatedly stated that you are indebted to me, Master Fairwhite? Despite my assurances to the contrary, have you not refused those assurances? Do you withdraw your promise of obligation now?"
With the best will in the world, my lord. Damn!
Fairwhite sighed and clenched his fists.
"I am ashamed, Don Lorenzo. I must now either forswear my obligation to the man who saved my life, or forswear my promise to the House of Bel Oster to keep its business as private as possible.
You must do neither, said the Don. And perhaps I can aid you directly in the pursuit of your master's business. Do you not see? If Don Jacobo does not know of your presence here, what obligation do you have to him? Clearly you are set here upon business. A plan, a scheme, a proposal of some sort. You're here to initiate something, or else you'd have your connections already in place. Don't be angry with yourself. This is all plain logic. Is it not true?
Fairwhite looked down and nodded reluctantly.
Then here it is. Although I am not as wealthy as Don Jacobo, I am a man of substantial means, and we are in complementary lines of business, are we not? Attend me tomorrow on my barge at the Shifting Revel. Make your proposal to me. Let us discuss it thoroughly.
There was a wicked gleam in Don Salvara's eyes. It could be seen despite the brightness of the sun overhead.
As you are indebted to me, repay this obligation by agreeing only to attend. Then, free of obligation, let us discuss business to our mutual advantage. Do you not see that I have a vested interest in taking whatever opportunity you present away from Jacobo, even if he never learns of it? Especially if he never learns of it. And am I not bold enough for your tastes? I swear your face grows longer as though by sorcery. What's wrong?
It is not you, Don Lorenzo. It is merely that the hands beneath are suddenly too generous once more. We have a saying that undeserved good fortune always conceals a snare.
Don't worry, Master Fairwhite. If it's really business that you want to discuss, never doubt that there will be hard work and bitter troubles enough waiting for us down the road. Are we in agreement, then? Will you dine with me tomorrow morning, take in the Shifting Revel, and discuss your proposal with me?
Fairwhite swallowed, looked Don Salvara in the eyes, and nodded firmly.
There is great sense in what you propose, and perhaps great opportunity for both of us. I will accept your hospitality, and I will tell you everything. Tomorrow, as you say. It cannot come soon enough for me.
It has been my pleasure to make your acquaintance, Master Fairwhite.
Don Salvara inclined his head. May we help your friend up out of the muck, and see you to your inn to ensure you have no further difficulties?
Your company would be most pleasing if only you would wait and look after poor Grauman and our cargo long enough for me to finish my offering within the temple.
Locke removed a small leather pack from the horse's jumble of goods and containers.
The offering will be more substantial than I had planned. But then, my masters understand that prayers of thanks are an unavoidable expense in our line of business.
7. The journey back to the Tumble home was slow, with Jean putting on an excellent show of misery, grogginess, and confusion. If the sight of two mud-splattered, overdressed outlanders and three horses escorted by a don struck anyone as unusual, they kept their comments to themselves and reserved their stares for Don Salvara's back. Along the way, they passed Carlo, now walking about casually in the plain garb of a labourer. He flashed rapid and subtle hand signals. With no sign of Bug, he would take up position at one of their prearranged rendezvous sites. And he would pray.
Lucas! Surely it can't be! I say, Lucas Fairwhite!
As Carlo vanished into the crowd, Galdo appeared just as suddenly, dressed in the bright silks and cottons of a prosperous Camori merchant. His slashed and ruffled coat alone was probably worth as much as the barge the gentleman bastards had poled up the river that morning. There was nothing now about him to remind the Don or his man of the alley cutthroats. Unmasked, with his hair slicked back under a small round cap, Galdo was the very picture of physical and fiscal respectability. He twirled a little lacquered cane and stepped toward Don Lorenzo's odd little party, smiling broadly.
"Why, Evante!
Locke, as Fairwhite, stopped and stared in mock astonishment, then held out a hand for a vigorous shake from the newcomer. "What a pleasant surprise!"
"Quite, Lucas, quite. But what the hell's happened to you? And to you, Grauman? You look as though you just lost a fight."
"Ah, we did." Locke looked down and rubbed his eyes. "Evante, it has been a very peculiar morning. Grau and I might not even be alive if not for our rather extraordinary guide here."
Pulling Galdo toward him, Locke held a hand out toward the Don.
"My Lord Salvara, may I introduce you to Evante Ecari, a solicitor of your Razona district? Evante, this is Don Lorenzo Salvara, of the Nacozza vineyards, if you still pay attention to those properties."
12 gods!
Galdo swept his hat off and bowed deeply at the waist.
"A Don! I should have recognized you immediately, my lord. 1,000 pardons. Evante Ecari, entirely at your service."
"A pleasure, Master Ecari." Don Salvara bowed correctly but casually, then stepped forward to shake the newcomer's hand. This signaled his permission to deduct any superfluous bowing and scraping from the conversation.
You know Master Fairwhite, then?"
"Lucas and I go well back, my lord."
Without turning his back on Don Salvara, he fussily brushed a bit of dried muck from the shoulders of Locke's black coat.
"I work out of Maraggio's, mostly, handling customers and license work for our friends in the north. Lucas is one of Bel Oster's best and brightest."
"Hardly." Locke coughed and smiled shyly. "Evante takes all the more interesting laws and regulations of your state and reduces them to plain Therin. He was my salvation on several previous ventures. I seem to have a talent for finding snares in Camor, and a talent for finding good Camorri to slip me out of them."
"Few clients would describe what I do in such generous terms. But what's this mud and these bruises? You said something of a fight?" "Yes. Your city has some very, enterprising thieves. Don Salvara and his man have just driven a pair of them off. I fear Grauman and I were getting the worst of the affair."
Galdo stepped over to Jean and gave him a friendly pat on the back. Jean's wince was fantastic theatre.
"My compliments, my lord Salvara. Lucas is what you might call a good vintage, even if he's not wise enough to take off those silly winter wools. I'm most deeply obligated to you for what you've done, and I'm at—"
"Hardly, sir, hardly."
Don Salvara held up one hand and hitched the other in his sword belt. "I did what my position demanded, no more. And I have too many promises of obligation being thrown at me already this afternoon." Don Lorenzo and Master Ecari fenced pleasantries for a few moments thereafter. Galdo eventually let himself be skewered with the politest possible version of "thanks but piss off."
"Well," he said at last, "this has been a wonderful surprise, but I'm afraid I have a client awaiting, and clearly, my lord Salvara, you and Lucas have business that I shouldn't intrude upon. With your permission?"
"Of course, of course. A pleasure, Master Ecari."
"Entirely mine, I assure you, my lord. Lucas, if you get a spare hour, you know where to find me, and should my poor skills be of any use to your affairs, you know I'll come running."
"Of course, Evante."
Locke grasped Galdo's right hand in both of his and shook enthusiastically.
"I suspect we may have need of you sooner rather than later."
He laid a finger alongside his nose. Galdo nodded, and then there was a general exchange of bows and handshakes and the other courtesies of disentanglement. As Galdo hurried away, he left a few hand signals in his wake, disguised as adjustments to his hat. "I know nothing about Bug. Going to look around." Don Salvara stared after him thoughtfully for a few seconds, then turned back to Locke as their small party resumed its journey toward the tumble home. They made small talk for a while. Locke had little trouble, as Fairwhite, letting his pleasure at seeing Ecari slip.
Soon he was projecting a very real downcast mood, which he claimed to be an incipient headache from the attempted strangling. Don Salvara and Conte left the two gentleman bastards in front of the Tumble Homes street-side citrus gardens, with admonitions to rest soundly that night and let all business wait for the morrow. No sooner were Locke and Jean safely alone in their suite, the harness full of precious goods thrown back over Jean's shoulders, than they were exploding out of their muddy finery and donning new disguises so they could hurry off to their own rendezvous points to wait for word of Bug, if any was forthcoming. This time, the swift dark shape that flitted silently from rooftop to rooftop in their wake went entirely unnoticed. 8. Fading false light. The hangman's wind and the swamp water mist glued clothes to skin and rapidly congealed Carlo and Galdo's tobacco smoke around them, half cloaking them in a cataract of greyness. The twins sat, hooded and sweating, in the locked doorway of a fairly well-kept pawn shop on the northern tip of the old citadel district. The shop was shuttered and barred for the evening. The keeper's family was obviously drinking something with a merry kick two floors above them.
"It was a good first touch," said Carlo.
"It was, wasn't it?"
"Our best yet. Hard to work all those disguises, what with us being the handsome ones."
"I confess that I wasn't aware we shared that complication."
"Now, now, don't be hard on yourself. Physically, you're quite my match. It's my scholarly gifts you lack, and my easy fearlessness, and my gift for women."
"If you mean the ease with which you drop coins when you're off a-cunting, you're right. You're a one-man charity ball for the whores of Camorre."
"Now that," said Carlo, "was genuinely unkind."
"You're right." The twins smoked in silence for a few seconds. "I'm sorry. Some of the savour's out of it tonight. The little bastard has my stomach twisted in knots. You saw..."
"Extra foot patrols. Pissed off. Yeah. Heard the whistles. I'm real curious about what he did and why he did it."
"He must have had his reasons. If it really was a good first touch, he gave it to us. I hope he's well enough for us to beat the piss out of him."
Stray shapes hurried past in the backlit mist. There was very little elder glass on the old citadel island, so most of the dying glow poured through from a distance. The sound of a horse's hooves on cobbles was coming from the south, and getting louder. At that moment, Locke was no doubt skulking near the Palace of Patience, eyeballing the patrols coming and going across the Black Bridge, making sure that they carried no small familiar prisoners, or small familiar bodies. Jean would be off at another rendezvous point, pacing and cracking his knuckles. Bug would never return straight to the Temple of Perelandro, nor would he go near the Tumble Home. The older gentleman bastards would sit their vigils for him out in the city and the steam. Wooden wheels clattered, and an annoyed animal whinnied. The sound of the horse-drawn cart came to a creaking halt not 20 feet from the Sansa brothers, shrouded in the mist.
"Evendando?"
A loud but uncertain voice spoke the name. Carlo and Galdo leapt to their feet as one. Evendando was their private recognition signal for an unplanned rendezvous.
"Here!"
Carlo cried, dropping his thin cigarette and forgetting to step on it. A man materialized out of the mist, bald and bearded, with the heavy arms of a working artisan and the rounded middle of moderate prosperity.
"I dunno exactly how this works," the man said, "but if one of you is Evendando, I was told I'd have 10 solons for delivering this here cask to this, doorway." He jerked a thumb over his shoulder toward the cart.
"Cask, indeed!"
Garlo fumbled with a coin purse, heart racing.
"What's, in this cask?"
"Ain't wine," said the stranger. "Ain't a very polite lad, neither. But 10 silvers is what he promised."
"Of course,"
Galdo counted rapidly, slapping bright silver discs down into the man's open palm.
10 for the cask, 1 more for forgetting all about this,
Holy hell! My memory must be cacked out, because I can't remember what you're paying me for.
Good man. Galdo slipped his purse back under his nightcloak and ran to help Carlo, who had mounted the cart and was standing over a wooden cask of moderate size. The cork stopper that would ordinarily be set into the top of the barrel was gone, leaving a small dark air hole. Carlo rapped sharply on the cask three times. Three faint taps came right back. With grins on their faces, the Sansa twins muscled the cask down off the cart and nodded farewell to the driver. The man remounted his cart and soon vanished into the night, whistling, his pockets jingling with more than 20 times the value of the empty cask.
"Well," Carlo said, when they'd rolled the cask back to the shelter of their doorway, "this vintage is probably a little young and rough for decanting. Put it in the cellar for 50 or 60 years? I was thinking we might just pour it in the river."
"Really?" Galdo drummed his fingers on the cask. "What's the river ever done to deserve that?" There was a series of noises from inside the cask that sounded vaguely like some sort of protest. Carlo and Galdo leaned down by the air hole together.
"Now, Bug," Carlo began, "I'm sure you have a perfectly good explanation for why you're in there and why we're out here worrying ourselves sick over you."
"It's a magnificent explanation, really."
Bug's voice was hoarse and echoed faintly.
"You're going to love it. But first, tell me how the game went."
"It was a thing of beauty," said Galdo. 3 weeks tops, and we're going to own this don down to his wife's last set of silk small clothes," added Carlo.
The boy groaned with obvious relief.
"Great! Well, what happened was, there was this pack of yellow jackets heading right for you. What I did to distract them pissed them off pretty fierce, so, I ran for this Cooper's that I know in Old Citadel. He does business with some of the wine places upriver, so he's got this yard of barrels just sitting around. Well, I just sort of invited myself in, jumped in one, and told him that if I could stay there until he delivered me here after false light, there'd be 8 solons in it for him."
"8? Carlo scratched his chin. "The cheeky bastard just asked for 10 and got 11.
"Yeah, well, that's okay," Bug coughed. "I got bored sitting around the cask yard, so I lifted his purse. Had about 2 solons worth of copper in it, so we got some back."
"I was going to say something sympathetic about you lying around inside a cask for half the day," said Galdo, "but that was a damn silly thing to do."
"Oh, come on,"
Bug sounded genuinely stung.
"He thought I was in the cask the whole time, so why would he suspect me? And you just gave him a load of money, so why would he suspect you? It's perfect. Locke would appreciate it."
"Bug," Carlo said, "Locke is like a brother to us, and our love for him has no bounds. But the 4 most fatal words in the Therin language are, 'Locke would appreciate it.'" "Rivaled only by 'Locke taught me a new trick,'" added Galdo. "The only person who gets away with Locke Lamora games is Locke Lamora. Because we think the gods are saving him up for a really big death, something with knives and hot irons, and 50,000 cheering spectators."
The brothers cleared their throats in unison.
"Well," Bug said finally, "I did it and I got away with it. Can we go home now?"
"Home," Carlo mused. "Sure. Locke and Jean are going to sob over you like grandmothers when they find out you're alive, so let's not keep them waiting."
"No need to get out. Your legs are probably cramped up," said Galdo.
"They are," Bug squeaked. "But you two really don't need to carry me all that way."
"You've never been more right about anything in your entire life, Bug."
Galdo took up position at one side of the cask and nodded at Carlo. Whistling in unison, the two brothers began rolling the cask along the cobbles, steering for the temple district, not necessarily by the fastest or smoothest route available. Interlude. Locke explains.
"It was an accident," Locke said at last. "They were both accidents."
"Excuse me, I must not have heard you."
Father Chain's eyes narrowed in the faint red glow of Locke's tiny ceramic lamp.
"I could have sworn you just said, 'Toss me over the parapet. I'm a useless little cuss, and I'm ready to die at this very moment.'"
Chains had moved their conversation up to the roof of the temple, where they sat comfortably beneath high parapets meant to be threaded with decorative plants. The long-lost hanging gardens of the House of Perelandro were a small but important aspect of the sacrificial tragedy of the eyeless priest, one more bit of stage-setting to draw sympathy, measured in coins. The clouds had roiled in overhead, palely reflecting the parti-coloured glimmers of night-lit Camor, obscuring the moons and the stars. The hangman's wind was little more than a damp pressure that nudged the sluggish air around Chains and Locke as the boy struggled to clarify himself.
"No, I meant to hurt them, but that's all. I didn't know those things would happen."
"Well, that I can almost believe."
Chains tapped the index finger of his right hand against his left palm, the Camori marketplace gesture for get on with it.
"So take me all the way. That almost is a major problem for you. Make me understand, starting with the first boy."
"Veslin," Locke whispered, "and Gregor, but Veslin first."
"Veslin indeed," Chains said. "Poor soul. Got a superfluous orifice carved into his neck by none other than your old master. He had to go buy one of those lovely shark's teeth from the kappa, and that one got used. So, why?"
"In the hill, some of the older boys and girls stopped going out to work."
Locke wove his fingers tightly together and stared down at them as though they might sprout answers.
"They would just take things when we came back each day, shake us down, make our reports to the master for us, leave things out sometimes."
Chains nodded.
"Privileges of age, size, and ass-kissing. If you survive this conversation, you'll find that it's just the same in most of the big gangs. Most."
"And there was one boy, Veslin. He'd do more. He'd kick us, punch us, take our clothes, make us do things. Lots of times he'd lie to the master about what we'd brought in. He'd give some of our things to the older girls in windows, and all of us in streets would get less food, especially the teasers."
Locke's small hands pulled apart and curled slowly into fists as he spoke.
"And if we tried to tell the master, he just laughed, like he knew about it and thought it was funny. And after we told, Veslin would just get worse."
Chains nodded, then tapped his index finger against his palm once more.
I thought about it a lot. None of us could fight him. He was too big. None of us had any big friends in the hill. And if we ganged up on Veslin, his big friends would all come after us. Veslin went out each day with some of his friends. We saw them while we were working. They wouldn't mess with our jobs, but they would watch us, you know. And Veslin would say things."
Locke's thin-lipped scowl would have been comical on a less dirty, less emaciated, less hollow-eyed boy. As it was, he looked like a slender wall gargoyle, working himself up for a pounce.
"Say things when we came back, about how we were clumsy or lazy and not taking enough. And he would push us more, and hit us more, and cheat us more. I thought and I thought and I thought about what to do."
"And the idea," said Chains, "the fateful idea, was it all yours?"
"Yes," the boy nodded vigorously, "all mine. I was alone when I had the idea. I saw some yellow jackets on patrol, and I thought about their sticks and their swords.
and I thought, what if they beat up Veslin? What if they had some reason not to like him? Locke paused for breath, and I thought more, but I couldn't work it. I didn't know how, but then I thought, what if they weren't angry with Veslin? What if I used them as an excuse to make the master angry with Veslin?
Chains nodded sagely. And where did you get the white iron coin?
Locke sighed. Streets. All of us who didn't like Veslin stole extra. We watched and we clutched and we worked hard. It took weeks. It took forever. I wanted white iron. I finally got one from a fat man dressed all in black wool. Funny coats and ties.
A Vadran. Chains seemed bemused. Probably a merchant come down to do some business. Too proud to dress for the weather at first, and sometimes too cheap to see a tailor in town. So you got a white iron coin. A full crown.
Everyone wanted to see it. Everyone wanted to touch it. I let them. Then I made them be quiet. I made them promise not to talk about it. I told them it was how we were going to get Veslin.
So what did you do with your coin?
Put it in a purse, a little leather purse, the kind we clutched all the time, and hid it out in the city so it wouldn't get taken from us. A place we knew about where nobody big could get to. And I made sure that Veslin and his friends were out of the hill, and I got the coin, and I went back in early one day. I gave up coppers and bread to the older girls on the door, but the coin was in my shoe.
Here Locke paused and fiddled with his little lamp, making the red glow waver on his face.
I put it in Veslin's room, the one where he and Gregor slept, one of the nice dry tombs, centre of the hill. I found a loose stone and hid the purse there, and when I was sure nobody had seen me, I asked to see the master. I said that some of us had seen Veslin at one of the Yellow Jacket stations, that he'd taken money from them, that he'd shown it to us, and said that if we told on him, he'd sell us to the Yellow Jackets.
Amazing. Chains scratched his beard. You know you don't mumble and stutter quite so much when you're explaining how you fucked someone over?
Locke blinked, then turned his chin up and stared hard at Chains. The older man laughed.
Wasn't a criticism, son, and I didn't mean to dam the flow. Keep the story coming. How did you know your old master would take offense at this? Did the Yellow Jackets ever offer you or your friends money?
No, Locke said. No, but I knew the master gave them money. For favors, for information. We saw him putting coins in purses sometimes. So I figured maybe I could work it the other way.
Ah.
Chains reached within the folds of his robe and withdrew a flat leather wallet, the color of baked bricks in the light of Locke's lamp. From this he withdrew a scrap of paper, onto which he shook a dark powder from another corner of the wallet. This object he rapidly folded, end over end, until it was a tight cylinder, and with courtly grace he lit one end by holding it in the lamp's flame. Soon he was sending ghostly grey swirls of smoke up to join the ghostly grey clouds. The stuff smelled like burning pine tar.
Forgive me,
Chains said, shifting his bulk to his right, so his direct exhalations would miss the boy by a few feet.
Two smokes a night is all I let myself have. The rough stuff before dinner and the smooth stuff after. Makes everything taste better.
So I'm staying for dinner?
Oh-ho, my cheeky little opportunist. Let's say the situation remains fluid. You go ahead and finish your story. You tipped your old master that Veslin was working as an auxiliary member of the famed Camor Constabulary. He must have thrown quite a fit.
He said he'd kill me if I was lying.
Locke scuttled to his own right, even farther from the smoke.
But I said he'd had the coin in his room, his and Gregor's. So he tore it apart. I hid the coin real well, but he found it. He was supposed to.
What did you expect to happen then?
I didn't know they'd get killed.
Chains couldn't hear any real grief in that soft and passionate little voice, but there seemed to be real puzzlement, real aggravation.
I wanted to beat Veslin. I thought maybe he'd do him up in front of all of us. We ate together most nights, the whole hill. Fuck-ups had to do tricks or serve and clean everything, sometimes get held down for caning. Drink ginger oil. I thought he'd get those things, maybe all those things.
Well, Chains held an inhalation of smoke for a particularly long moment, as though the tobacco could fill him with insight, and looked away from Locke. When he finally exhaled, he did so in little puffs, forming wobbly crescents that fluttered a few feet and faded into the general haze. He harumphed and turned back to the boy.
Well, you certainly learned the value of good intentions, didn't you? Caning, cleaning and serving. Poor Veslin got cleaned and served, all right. How did your old master do it?
He was gone for a few hours, and when he came back, he waited in Veslin's room. When Veslin and Gregor came back that night, there were older boys nearby, so they couldn't go anywhere. And then the master just killed them, both. Cut Veslin's throat, and some of the others said he looked at Gregor for a while, and he didn't say anything, and then he just...
Locke made the same sort of jabbing motion with two fingers that Chains had made at him earlier.
He did Gregor, too.
Of course he did. Poor Gregor.
Gregor Foss, wasn't it? One of those lucky little orphans old enough to remember his last name. Not unlike yourself. Of course your old master did him, too. He and Veslin were best friends, right? Two draughts from the same bottle. It was an elementary assumption that one would know that the other was hiding a fortune under a rock. Chains sighed and rubbed his eyes.
Elementary. So, now that you've told your part, would you like me to point out where you fucked everything up? And to let you know why most of your little friends in streets that helped you pluck that white iron coin are going to be dead before morning?
Chapter 2. Second Touch at the Teeth Show. Idler's Day, the 11th hour of the morning at the Shifting Revel. The sun was once again the baleful white of a diamond and a fire, burning an arc across the empty sky and pouring down heat that could be felt against the skin. Locke stood beneath the silk awning atop Don Salvara's pleasure barge, dressed in the clothes and mannerisms of Lucas Fairwhite, and stared out at the gathering revel. There was a troop of rope dancers perched atop a platform boat to his left, four of them standing in a diamond pattern about 15 feet apart. Great lengths of brightly coloured silk rope stretched amongst the dancers around their arms and chests and necks. It seemed that each dancer was working four or five strands simultaneously. These strands formed an ever-shifting cat's cradle between the dancers, and suspended in this web by clever hitches were all manner of small objects, swords, knives, overcoats, boots, glass statuettes, sparkling knick-knacks. All these objects were slowly but gradually moving in various directions as the dancers twirled arms and shifted hips, slipping old knots loose and forming newer, tighter ones with impossibly smooth gestures. It was a minor wonder on a busy river of wonders, not the least of which was Don and Doña Salvara's barge. While many nobles hauled trees to and from their orchards on the water, Locke's hosts were the first to go one step further. Their pleasure barge was a permanent floating orchard in miniature. Perhaps 50 paces long and 20 wide, it was a double-hulled wooden rectangle stuffed with soil to support a dozen oak and olive trees. Their trunks were a uniform night black, and their rustling cascades of leaves were unnatural emerald, bright as lacquer, an outward testimony to the subtle science of alchemical botany. Wide circular stairs, crisscrossed with patches of leafy shade, wound up several of these trees, leading to the Don's silk-topped observation box, comfortably perched within the branches to give the occupants an unobstructed forward view. On each side of this supremely ostentatious sliver of floating forest were 20 hard rowers, seated on outrigger-like structures that kept the top-heavy central portion of the yacht from plunging sideways. The box could easily hold 20. This morning it held only Locke and Jean, the Don and the Donya, and the ever-watchful Conte, currently tending a liquor cabinet so elaborate it might have been mistaken for an apothecary's lab. Locke returned his gaze to the rope dancers, feeling a strange kinship with them. They weren't the only ones with ample opportunity to screw up a delicate public act this morning.
"Master Fairwhite, your clothes!"
Doña Sofia Salvara shared the forward rail of the observation box with him, her hands scant inches from his.
"You would look so very fine in one of your Emberlane winters, but why must you suffer them in our summer? You shall sweat yourself as red as a rose. Might you not take something off?"
My lady, I assure you, most comfortable."
13 gods, she was actually flirting with him, and the little smile that crept on and off her husband's face told Locke that the Salvaras had planned this in advance. A little close feminine attention to fluster the awkward master merchant, perfectly staged and perfectly common. A game before the game, so to speak.
"I find that whatever discomfort these clothes bring me in your very interesting climate only serves to goad me into concentrating. Keeps me alert, you see. A better man of business."
Jean, standing a few paces behind the two of them, bit his tongue. Throwing blondes at Locke Lamora was not unlike throwing lettuce at sharks, and the Doña Sofia was very blonde. One of those gorgeous therin rarities with skin like burnt amber and hair the colour of almond butter. Her eyes were deep and steady, her curves artfully not concealed by a dark orange summer dress with a cream-white underskirt barely showing at the hem. Well, it was just the Salvara's luck to run up against a thief with the most peculiar damned taste in women. Jean could admire the Doña for them both. His limited role today, and his injuries, would give him little else to do.
"Our master Fairwhite is made of unusually stern stuff, my dear."
Don Lorenzo lounged in a far corner of the forward rail, dressed in loose white silks and an orange vest matching his wife's dress. His white neckerchief hung rakishly loose, and only the bottom clasp of his vest was fastened.
"Yesterday he took the beating of a lifetime. Today he wears enough wool for 5 men and dares the sun to do its worst. I must say I'm more and more pleased with myself that I've kept you out of Jacopo's grasp, Lucas."
Locke acknowledged the smiling Don with a slight bow and an agreeably awkward smile of his own.
"Do at least have something to drink, Master Fairwhite."
Doña Sofia's hand briefly settled over Locke's, long enough for him to feel the assorted calluses and chemical burns no manicure could conceal. She was a true alchemical botanist, then. This barge was her direct handiwork as well as her general design. A formidable talent, by implication a calculating woman. Lorenzo was obviously the more impulsive one, and if he was wise he'd weigh his wife's opinion before agreeing to any of Lucas Fairwhite's proposals. Locke therefore favoured her with a shy smile and an awkward cough. Let her think she was getting to him.
"A drink would be very pleasing," he said. "But, I fear that you shall have no reassurance for my condition, kind Doña Sofia. I have done much business in your city. I know how drinking is done here when men and women speak of business."
"Mornings for sweat and nights for regret," Don Salvara said as he stepped from the rail and gestured to his servant. "Conte, I do believe Master Fairwhite has just requested nothing less than a ginger scald."
Conte moved adroitly to fill this request, first selecting a tall crystal wine flute, into which he poured 2 fingers of purest Camori ginger oil, the colour of scorched cinnamon. To this he added a sizable splash of milky pear brandy, followed by a transparent heavy liquor called Argento, which was actually a cooking wine flavoured with radishes. When this cocktail was mixed, Conte wrapped a wet towel around the fingers of his left hand and reached for a covered brazier smouldering to the side of the liquor cabinet. He withdrew a slender metal rod, glowing orange-red at the tip, and plunged it into the cocktail. There was an audible hiss and a small puff of spicy steam. Once the rod was staunched, Conte stirred the drink briskly and precisely 3 times, then presented it to Locke on a thin silver plate. Locke had practiced this ritual many times over the years, but when the cold burn of the ginger scald hit his lips, limning every tiny crack with stinging heat and outlining every crevice between teeth and gums in exquisite pain, even before it went to work on tongue and throat, he was never able to fully hold back the memories of Shades Hill and of the thief-maker's admonishments. Of a liquid fire that seemed to creep up his sinuses and burn behind his eyes until he wanted to tear them out. Expressing discomfort at his first sip of the drink was much easier than feigning interest in the Doña.
"Incomparable!"
He coughed, and then, with quick, jerky motions, he loosened his black neckcloths just the slightest bit. The Salvaras smirked charmingly together.
"I'm reminded again why I have such success selling gentler liquors to you people."
2. Once per month, there was no trading done in the shifting market. Every 4th Idler's Day, the merchants stayed clear of the great sheltered circle abutting the Angevine River. Instead, they drifted or anchored nearby, while half the city came out to see the shifting revel. Camor had never possessed a great stone or elderglass amphitheatre, and had fallen instead into the curious custom of rebuilding its spectator circle anew at each revel. Huge, multi-storied observation barges were towed out and anchored firmly against the stone breakwaters surrounding the shifting market, like floating slices cut from the heart of great stadiums. Each barge was operated by a rival family or merchant combine and decked in unique livery. They competed fiercely with one another to fill their seats, and inter-vessel brawls between the habitual customers of particularly beloved barges were not unknown. When properly aligned, these barges formed an arc about halfway around the circumference of the shifting market. A channel was left clear for boats entering and leaving the centre of the calm water, and the rest of the periphery was reserved for the pleasure barges of the nobility. A good 100 or so could be counted on at any revel, and half again as many for major festivals such as this one. Less than 3 weeks remained until the midsummer mark and the Day of Changes. Even before the entertainments began, the shifting revel was its own spectacle, a great tide of rich and poor, floating and on foot, jostling for position in a traditional contest much loved for its lack of rules. The yellow jackets were always out in force, but more to prevent hard words and fisticuffs from escalating than to prevent disturbances altogether. The revel was a city-wide debauch, a rowdy public service the Duke was happy to underwrite from his treasury. There were few things like a good revel to pull the fangs from any unrest before it had time to fester. Feeling the fire of the approaching noon, despite the silk awning over their heads, Locke and his hosts compounded their situation by drinking ginger scalds as they stared out across the rippling heat haze at thousands of Camorri packing the commoner barges. Conte had prepared identical drinks for his lord and lady, though with a touch less ginger oil, perhaps, which Graumann had served them, as Camorri etiquette dictated in these situations. Locke's glass was half empty. The liquor was a ball of expanding warmth in his stomach and a vivid memory in his throat.
"Business," he said at last. "You have both been so kind to Grau and myself. I agreed to repay this kindness by revealing my business here in Camor. So let us speak of it, if that would please you."
"You have never had a more eager audience in your life, Master Fairwhite."
The Don's hired rowers were bringing them into the shifting revel proper, and closing on dozens of more traditional pleasure barges, some of them crammed with dozens or hundreds of guests, The Don's eyes were alive with greedy curiosity. Tell on.
The kingdom of the Seven Marrows is coming apart at the seams.
Locke sighed.
This is no secret.
The Don and the Donya nonchalantly sipped their drinks, saying nothing.
The canton of Emberlane is peripheral to the major conflict, but the Graf von Emberlane and the Black Table are both working, in different directions, to place it in the way of substantial harm.
The Black Table? Asked the Don.
I beg pardon.
Locke took the tiniest sip of his drink and let new fire trickle under his tongue.
The Black Table is what we call the Council of Emberlane's most powerful merchants. My masters of the House of Bel-Oster are among them. In every respect, save the military and the matter of taxes, they run the canton of Emberlane. And they are tired of the Graf, and tired of the trade guilds in the other six cantons of the Marrows, tired of limitations. Emberlane grows rich on new means of speculation and enterprise. The Black Table sees the old guilds as a weight around their neck.
Curious, said the Donya, that you say there and not our. Is this significant?
To a point.
Another sip of the drink, a second of feigned nervousness.
The House of Bel-Oster agrees that the guilds have outlasted their usefulness, that the trade practices of centuries past should not be set in stone by guild law. We do not necessarily agree.
He sipped the drink yet again and scratched the back of his head.
That the Graf von Emberlane should be deposed while he is out of the canton with most of his army, showing his flag on behalf of his cousins in Parley and Somne.
Holy 12! Don Salvara shook his head, as though to clear it of what he'd just heard. They can't be serious. Your state is smaller than the Duchy of Camor, exposed to the sea on two sides. Impossible to defend.
And yet the preparations are underway. Emberlane's banks and merchant houses do 4 times the yearly business of the next richest canton in the Marrows. The Black Table fixates upon this. Gold should certainly be considered potential power. The Black Table errs by imagining it to be direct power in and of itself.
He finished his drink in one long, deliberate draught.
In 2 months, civil war will have broken out anyway. The succession is a mess. The Stradas and the Dvorims, the Razuls and the Strigs, they are all sharpening knives and parading men. Yet, as we speak, the merchants of Emberlane are moving to arrest the remaining nobility while the Graf is away, to claim the navy, to raise a levy of free citizens, to hire mercenaries. In short, they will now attempt to secede from the Marrows. It is unavoidable.
And what specifically does this have to do with you coming here?
The Donya's knuckles were white around her wine flute. She grasped the full significance of Fairwhite's story. A fight larger than anything seen in centuries. Civil war mixed with possible economic disaster. It is the opinion of my masters, the House of Bel-Oster, that rats in the hold have little chance to take the wheel of a ship that is about to run aground. But those same rats may very easily abandon the ship.
3. In the center of the shifting revel, a great many tall iron cages had been sunk into the water. Some of these served to support wooden slats on which performers, victims, fighters, and attendants could stand. A few particularly heavy cages restrained dark shapes that circled ominously under the translucent grey water. Platform boats were rowed around at a steady clip, showing off rope dancers, knife throwers, acrobats, jugglers, strongmen, and other curiosities. The excited shouts of barkers with long brass speaking trumpets echoed flatly off the water. First up at any revel were the pennants bouts, where petty offenders from the Palace of Patience could volunteer for mismatch combat in exchange for reduced sentences or slightly improved living conditions. At present, a hugely muscled Nicovezzo, punishing hand, one of the Duke's own household guard, was handing out the beatings. The soldier was armoured in black leather, with a gleaming steel breastplate and a steel helmet crested with the freshly severed fin of a giant flying fish. Scales and spines scintillated as the soldier stepped back and forth under the bright sun, striking out seemingly at leisure with an iron-shod staff. The Nicovezzo stood on a platform that was small but rock-steady. A series of circular wooden flats surrounded him, separated by an arm's-length span of water. These wobbly, unstable platforms were occupied by about 24 slender, grimy prisoners, each armed with a small wooden cudgel. A concerted rush might have overwhelmed their armoured tormentor, but this lot seemed to lack the temperament for cooperation. Approaching the Nicovezzo singly or in little groups, they were being dropped one after another with skull-rattling blows. Little boats circled to fish out unconscious prisoners before they slipped under the water forever. The Duke, in his mercy, did not allow penance bouts to be deliberately lethal. Locke held his empty wine flute out for just a second. Conte plucked it out of his fingers with the grace of a swordsman disarming an opponent. When the Don's manservant stepped toward the liquor cabinet, Locke cleared his throat. "No need to refill that particular glass just yet, Conte. Too kind, too kind. But with your permission, my lord and Lady Salvara, I should like to offer a pair of gifts. One as a matter of simple hospitality, the other as a... well, you'll see. Grauman?" Locke snapped his fingers, and Jean nodded. The heavy-set man moved over to a wooden table just beside the liquor cabinet and picked up two heavy leather satchels, each of which had iron-reinforced corners and small iron locks sewn into their covers. Jean set these down where the Salvaras could easily see them, and then stepped back so Locke could unseal the satchels with a delicate key of carved ivory. From the first satchel he withdrew a cask of pale aromatic wood, perhaps 1 foot in height and half that in diameter, which he then held out for Don Salvara's examination. A plain black brand on the surface of the cask read, "Brandvin Osterschalin 502. Don Lorenzo's breath hissed in between his teeth. Perhaps his nostrils even flared, though Locke kept the face of Lucas Fairwhite politely neutral. 12 gods, a 502! Lucas, if I seem to be teasing you for your refusal to part with your goods, please accept my deepest—" "You needn't apologize, my lord." Locke held up a hand and mimicked the Don's gesture for shooing words down out of the air. "For your bold intervention on my behalf, Don Salvara, and for your excellent hospitality this morning, fair Doña, please accept this minor ornament for your cellars."
"Minor?"
The Don took the cask and cradled it as though it were an infant not 5 minutes born.
I have a 506 and a pair of 504s. I don't know of anyone in Camor that has a 502, except probably the Duke."
"Well," said Locke, "my masters have kept a few on hand ever since the word got out that it was a particularly good blend. We use them to break the ice in matters of grave business importance."
In truth, that cask represented an investment of nearly 800 full crowns and a sea trip up the coast to Ashmere, where Locke and Jean had contrived to win it from an eccentric minor noble in a rigged card game. Most of the money had actually gone to evade or buy off the assassins the old man had later sent after his property. The 502 vintage had become almost too precious to drink.
"What a grand gesture, Master Fairwhite."
Doña Sofia slipped a hand through the crook of her husband's elbow and gave him a possessive grin.
"Lorenzo, love, you should try to rescue strangers from Emberlane more often. They're so charming."
Locke coughed and shuffled his feet. Hardly, my lady. Now, Don Salvara, please do call me Lorenzo.
Don Lorenzo, what I have to show you next relates rather directly to my reason for coming here. From the second satchel he drew out a similar cask, but this one was marked only with a stylized A within a circle of vines.
This, said Locke, is a sample drawn from last year's distillation, the 559.
Don Salvara dropped the cask of 502. The Doña, with girlish agility, shot out her right foot to hook the cask in mid-air and let it down to the deck with a slight thump rather than a splintering crash. Unbalanced, she did manage to drop her ginger scald. The glass vanished over the side and was soon 20 feet under water. The Salvaras steadied one another, and the Don picked his cask of 502 back up, his hands shaking.
"Lucas," he said, "surely, surely you must be kidding."